I think two different ways to talk about the adult and the youth system is the adult system is really about, it's about emergency services. It's kind of 911. It's like the emergency room in the sense that there's a shelter system and a rapid rehousing system, ideally, in every community, right? Where you're identifying a need and you're getting services relatively quickly. The youth service system is more supportive. It's more like it's got more checkups, counseling. You know, there's more funding and services linked to supporting a young person through transitional housing, which in the adult services world is something that that both at the state and the federal level we're wanting to encourage a move away from transitional housing and a move towards more rapid rehousing and rent assistance and things like that. But in the youth world, we recognize that in the long run is going to continue to be an investment that is important because youth have different needs, have different experiences. They need their services linked to school, maybe family reunification, and things like that. So what is causing homelessness at the state level? Rents. Rents are rising. And as rents are increasing in our state, wages are not keeping pace. So, and rents and wages, I think we did a big study a few years ago in 2015, the first big statewide affordable housing needs survey. And one of the assumptions that study helped debunk is that affordability is just an I-5 problem. We know now that it's not. We were able to use that study to confirm that in every county in the state, the gap between rent and what people can afford to pay is growing. Vacancies are a big part of that. Housing stock is another big part of that. Wages, of course, are part of the conversation, but lots of factors contribute to that in every county, not just King County, not even just the I-5 corridor, that even in more rural parts of your county or in more rural parts of eastern Washington, either because of stock or because of wages or because of vacancy rates, there's lots of things that exacerbate affordability, which in turn makes helps push families or individuals towards homelessness. So you can see Washington, here we are in Washington, our vacancy rates over time are trending in the wrong direction at the state average. And that's true of other counties in our state as well. There's Clark. And then the national average, of course, is following that same trend, although the national average at 5.9% is much higher than the state average of 3.3% or Clark County's average of 2.2%. I apologize. I know some of you in the back probably can't see that. Anyway, the point is vacancy rates headed in the wrong direction. So as I mentioned, affordability is a big driver of homelessness. This national research that we've found indicates that $100 increase in rent causes a 6% increase in homelessness. So each time rents are increasing, that also logically exacerbates homelessness, right? Because it exacerbates that gap between affordability and wages in any given community. This is something that we look back at the state level frequently. So at the beginning of this, in 2006, this is when the document recording fees and the Affordable Housing for All Act was started. So that's kind of our baseline. This is also kind of the beginning times for the HMIS system, which is the state level data system that every county in the state contributes information to and that we then roll up and look at the state level so we can keep track of of homelessness in every community in the state. So broadly, we're headed in the right direction, especially after the recession. But you can see an increase again, more recently, in homelessness at the state level. I think a lot of the information that we're seeing at the state level is telling us that again, this is exacerbated by the recovery of the housing industry and the increase, you know, more recent increases in rents and other factors that have made housing more expensive for a lot of households. Again, wages aren't necessarily keeping pace. So to get into lots of things contribute to increases in rent. I think what I really want to focus on today and chat with you all about when I'm done with the slides is the local impacts. There's lots of things that communities can do to influence the cost of housing in their community. Land use regulations, other regulations related to land use are a place where each of us in our community can have a little bit of influence. With our city councils, with county councils, with planning commissions at the city and county level, and that's the beginning of opportunity for affordability, where there's a lot of conversation at the permit desk, with developers, with your planning commissions about choices that we all are making around where we're siting housing, how easy is it to break ground. Sorry.
I just wanted to comment on that. Out in Camas, they are building a lot of housing, but it's for people that have money. Low-income housing sucks out in Camas. And they're not meeting our need. They just add more expensive housing, and then people have to move, and that drives our homeless rate up out there. I've actually have seen several people in Camas for the first time living on the street, and I've never seen that. And I've been out there all my life, and it just shocks me that the state and the federal government are not meeting that need to house low-income people. We have very little low-income housing out in that area. But instead, they keep putting up those nice big houses that cost $300,000 to $600,000, and you know, and that's great for the people that are moving into the area that might have that amount of money. But for the rest of us that have lived there for a long time, and you know, and we might want to move because of, for some reason, too small housing or something, and you know, and I can't find anything, and I need to get out of the hills of Camas. And I can't find anything because they just got all these big, nice, fat, fancy houses that are $2,000 a month. I can't afford that. So,
right.
Yeah, that.
And this is a familiar story
Around
the state. And I think you could find a similar story in every county.
Oh, yeah.
In Washington.
Same for Washougal, too, because the towns are kind of connected.
Right. So, and I think part of our challenge is, for better or for worse, I think for a lot of reasons it's for better, but we have a limited amount of leverage, right, that at the state level. Certainly we can point at things, but just like with document recording fees, right, the slice of document recording fees that we have influence over is relatively small compared to the amount of influence that you all have at the local level over the bulk of the document recording fees that are coming into this community. So, but even that, and I'll talk about that in a little bit, like document recording fees are really only going to help part of the population. As you're seeing new projects break ground, ideally, you're seeing a balance of larger, higher income housing and housing that supports new families. Retired folks, you know, people who are interested in a smaller unit, or you know, have or maybe a first time, not a second or third time home buyer. I skip one? So this is a great lead into this slide, right? So what we want to do is bring, in any given community or city, bring incomes and the cost of housing back in line so that people can afford housing within their community. I think in a worst case scenario, right? So I think everybody's heard about San Francisco, the challenges that they've had. I think when we're seeing competition over land supply, high and middle incomes competing for a given property or piece of land, you know, generally the winner is, you know, the population that can afford or can pay the most in a competitive market. There is, I think, though, and we talked a lot about this at the state level, and this kind of leads back to your comment about Camas. Generally, for us, any housing is going to be good housing. So for this is one project in our state. As an example, this is designed as market rate housing. This happens to be on my way to work, which is why I grabbed this as an example. It's a project that I've seen come up, and I heard a lot of controversy in Thurston County and Olympia about this project because it was market rate housing downtown in the midst of my city's challenges around homelessness and affordable housing. So there was a lot of concern. Why are we doing more market rate housing when we have homelessness in our town, when we have housing challenges for lower income households? Well, I think part of the reason that at the state level we feel like any housing is good housing is because any housing is going to depreciate over time. So in this project, for example, this project includes studio units that, when first built, appear to be expensive, but over time, as they depreciate, it will become more affordable for a full-time minimum wage worker. That said, we also see over time that as any given community grows the amount of new units that are coming online, it also helps free up other units in the community for someone who might need, who might be able to backfill. So one of the challenges that we saw at the end of the recession, as the housing market was getting better, there was a lot of conversation about, the housing market was getting better, but mortgage rates and new mortgage finance restrictions were making it more challenging for first-time homebuyers to get into homes, which was exacerbating rents. It was exacerbating a lot of challenges for, you know, and we were seeing people stay in units around the state who probably could qualify, you know, a few years ago could have qualified for a home or for a mortgage, but because of the new restrictions, they were sticking around in a unit, which was exacerbating things for a lot of households who really would have been competing for or getting into that rental unit a few years prior. Now that we're seeing the market free up and we're seeing more apartments coming online, especially apartments that are smaller, studios, things like that, hopefully we'll see that start to change again. So part of, I think, to get back to that conversation about what can we do at the local level to encourage more flexible housing, to encourage more a broader array of housing affordability so that we can get more people into private market units. Smaller units, more flexible units. Sightline Institute did some research in the last 6 months. I think the article, September. It's a great article about there was a movement in some cities across the country and in our state and in Oregon where they were doing apartments was one of the nicknames in the Seattle area, but kind of small unit or shared services within an apartment complex. So instead of a traditional apartment where you've got your own kitchen and all your own facilities, some of these projects were sharing services and facilities. So instead of having your own full kitchen, you'd have a kitchenette, and then down the hall, you'd have a shared kitchen. So those sorts of things helped reduce the cost of the project overall and reduce the cost of a unit for a person. So those sorts of units were really attractive to younger people or people who were new to a given market or people who might want to live close to work but couldn't afford a traditional unit in the area. Over time, so some of those broke ground and rented up in King County. And then over time, this article tracks the ratcheting up of various building code and other development requirements for those projects. So now fewer of those projects are happening because of some of these new restrictions on them. So I think if that's a negative trend or a bad trend as far as affordability is concerned, that's something that I would encourage you all to be mindful of when you're thinking about, you know, what policies, what things can we do at the local level with the city or the county, how can we encourage them? And I think that, you know, this Sightline example is a great little article that helps tell that story to a planner at your city or your county to say, hey, there's small things we can do to encourage a developer, to give developers who are doing new housing projects more flexibility. So this is a helpful lead for that. Back in the day, there were lots of different, and again, this is, you know, my personal experience at some of the projects in my neighborhood that are, that back in the day, duplexes were not regulated like they are now. In my neighborhood, this project could not break ground in my neighborhood anymore, but 100 years ago, or in 1901, duplexes were, I'm not a planner by trade, so somebody help me with the, it was not a conditional use, it was
matter of right.
A matter of right, thank you. Same with a more of an urban, a mixed use development, right? Where, you know, where you saw retail on the first floor and small units or housing upstairs. In some communities, this kind of new urbanism development is gaining popularity again. Are there ways that you can encourage this sort of housing or support it where it exists, incentivize? And then, of course, at the broad level, we have, in the last 30, 50 years, decreased the level of services and the number of people served by services like state hospitals, and now permanent supportive housing is going to be, over time, taking the place of that, right? So that's a big part of what every community needs to be planning for is, how do we do permanent supportive housing? I mean, socially, this is not acceptable anymore. What we want to do is make sure that as we have done away with services at that level, are we making sure that communities are able to invest in things like permanent supportive housing so that there are smaller focused services for people who have a long-term need that is not something that they're going to be able to find, that they're not going to make it in a private market rental, so they're going to need services, housing matched with medical services at a special site. This was, of course, another alternative. 100 years ago in Olympia, we had neighborhoods right by the Capitol called Little Hollywood. Again, this is gone now. This whole area is a park. But I think a lot of these populations that used to be accepted where you had unsubsidized housing that right downtown, very affordable. This sort of housing now has moved out, you know, as we all know, it's It's moved out to the woods. It's moved out to being literally homeless and unsheltered on the street or other places unfit for human habitation. So I think part of our challenge at the state level is finding policy solutions, since just like rents are increasing, we are having an increasing challenge. We have relatively the same amount of resources, or a declining amount of resources, for a growing population and a growing world of need. But whether it's housing or community service block grants, I mean, it's a general trend in other social services as well. So I think an ongoing trend, both at the state, the federal, and the local level, is how are we going to do more work and facilitate more of these conversations with an increasing need and a decreasing number of resources, number of dollars. So I think along those lines, you'll see, and I'll talk about this in a moment, trends like us really pushing towards, you know, serving people who have the highest need first. So I had a conversation during lunch about how we've been working really hard to make sure that that's happening with WIOA and employment services. That's been something that we've been working hard at the state level on housing services for as well. We want to make sure that we're serving people based on their need. Not everybody gets the same service, but that we have a conversation about what are your needs, and let's make sure that we're serving your needs, not that everybody's getting the same level of service. A big part of that for us at the state level, and right now we've been drafting a new state housing plan, and need-based services has been a big part of that. So making sure that we're encouraging, with the document recording fees that we administer, that those dollars are going towards the highest level of need, people who are literally unsheltered first, and that we're implementing efficient and tested strategies. We're doing that through our contracts, and we're also doing things like, just in the last 6 months, we've rolled out a report card that allows you all to start to look at not only data in your county, but in other counties and neighboring counties, and start to have conversations about, oh, what's happening, you know, down the road, up the road, other side of the state. So you can start to have conversations among your peers around what's working, what's not. Why is another community similar to yours in size having a different result in services? So hopefully those report cards on homeless services are a helpful tool for you all. But we'll also be implementing other parts of our contracts in the future to encourage, again, more services towards people who have the highest need. And those services include coordinated entry, and rapid rehousing services, quickly moving people from shelter into the private rental market, or permanent supportive housing, depending on their needs. So I think a secondary part of our plan and where we're headed in the future is again, you know, understanding and advocating for the changes that need to happen in order to move towards that need-based level of service, in order to make sure that we're all serving first the households and the families and the individuals who have the highest level of need. In this case, in the conversation about housing and homelessness, people who are literally unsheltered. And also, we want to make sure that as we're providing services, not only are we advocating for policy, but we're also making sure that things are linking to, as I mentioned before, behavioral supports, domestic violence services, substance abuse, I have not mentioned yet, But obviously that's another, I think there's been a lot of conversation nationally and in the state about linking, breaking down barriers to housing and starting to have broader conversations about, you know, substance abuse. Instead of that being a barrier for housing, making sure that we're starting to create systems and support networks for people so that they can be housed and get substance abuse treatment. And these are the values that will be part of our plan that influence those goals. So everyone deserves housing. No one should be unsheltered. We want to lower barriers at every level so that we can get everyone housing. Not we'll provide housing when you're clean and sober. Like, let's get you housed so you can get sober. And then a big part of what we'll be doing in the next years, in the next couple of years with our contracts, is implementing some changes to incentivize this work. So maybe I should leave this up. I think this is a great place to leave us for questions. So let's talk. I'm kind of hoping that that some of this is exciting enough that I don't know, that it will help lead us into a little bit of a conversation about some of this work.
So you mentioned the pod housing and how that there were barriers of entry put in place in the communities in which they were being built. As advocates in our own communities and in our own county, what are some of the things that you would suggest that we can do to help our legislators at the local level to see progressive changes in housing as a good thing? I mean, I can assume obviously people were concerned with more bodies in one area, maybe the bringing in of lower income into a specific area. I mean, how can we be helpful?
I think, so I'm not a planner.
Understood.
So I'll warn you, like, this is, so I think but there are some general things that communities can do to influence, you know, if a city council or a planning commission is having a conversation about changes in code related to housing, hopefully they're moving in a direction of encouraging, incentivizing more flexible, smaller units, you know, and projects that encourage apartments or some approach that's maybe not traditional. But if I think for me a red flag is if a developer comes in and is like, hey, I've done some market studies and I think I could make this work, but we need to have a conversation. There's some stuff in your code that's preventing me or that's going to make it challenging for me. Maybe it's because fees are based on per unit rather than square foot. You know, I think that's an example potentially. Or because every unit's required to have certain fixtures in it. I think those are the sorts of things that communities can look at changing, softening, you know, even if some of those things are moving to conditional conversations instead of black and white, you know, more strict policy regulations on those things. If there's more flexibility, it'll allow developers to make some decisions based on markets that they're seeing, which I think creates a lot of opportunity for a variety of income levels. But that per foot conversation is something that the statewide Affordable Housing Advisory Board has talked about on and off over the years, and that's, you know, I think at the state level, it's like, oh, we'll never get that done at the state level. But obviously, as communities work towards those sorts of changes, it'll be easier over time to influence, you know, building code and things like that at you know, more global levels. But I think you know, King County as an example, that they've been trending, unfortunately, in the other direction. So I think opportunities for your community would be moving towards a more permissive perspective on, you know, what is a unit and what does that look like, and are there ways that you can change that so that it's a unit is more affordable for everybody in the community. Obviously, there'll always be a market demand for traditional units, larger houses, multiple bedrooms, but are you allowing for flexibility with the developer if they want to do a project for other kinds of households?
So you're saying King County is going in the opposite direction?
Yeah.
In what way?
Just because there was flexibility a few years ago on a more... Yeah, and some of that flexibility has gone away in the last couple of years, unfortunately. So they're seeing less of those apartment kinds of, shared kitchen facilities kind of projects.
Do they say why they're going away from that flexibility and moving more toward restrictions? What's their reasoning behind that?
I don't know. I don't know. I could look into it. Like, there's folks in the city of Seattle who do a lot of work on housing policy, like Leslie Price in the mayor's office, who would know more.
I could give an example.
That'd be great.
They had a whole group of people come together. I think it was called HALA. That looked at, something like 56 different things they could do around affordable housing, a lot like the City of Vancouver Task Force. And the one thing that ended up being the most controversial out of these dozens and dozens of recommendations, and they backed off of it right away because the response was changing the single-family home zoning to allow a little more flexibility to have duplexes and things. And what that shows is that these are not policy mistakes that have happened over time. These are intentional decisions by local communities because there are competing interests. There are, neighborhoods see some of these changes as basically taking money out of their pocket because of housing values. I think you can argue whether that's true or not, but that is, I think, why we have the laws that we do and why it's so difficult to, but needed to move in the direction that we're talking about.
Well, I think there's sometimes a fear of the affordable housing today is the slum of tomorrow.
Right.
And dealing with that concern or that argument, I think, has to be part of the discussion. Because people that want to build know that if they think that 20 years from now, these housing that you're building down the street is going to be a slum.
Right. And I think the somehow that in people's minds went from it's not about, so that somehow now applies to duplexes, for example, right? Whereas 100 years, if you go to a community where the housing is 100 years old, people live in large single family, small single family duplexes all together, and it seems to work fine. You go to a community that's built in the last 20, 30 years, you don't have that mix. And it's part of it is we need to have a real community conversation about what is that danger? What are we afraid of? And is it a realistic fear? And what are we trading away to get it? Do I have to send my kids to a school where the homelessness rates are incredibly high in order to live in a neighborhood where you can only build single-family homes of a certain size?
Well, it seems like we're working so hard to make everything so diversified. Those communities truly are more diversified, and they've been that way for a long time.
But does some of it emerge from what I heard you say was Commerce's priority, which is funding the most severe need as opposed to funding future funds that are only going to the most extreme cases rather than when you were talking in the committee, the focus and the example that popped into my head was rivers and their environmental status, where the investment was made in the least damage because once that was cured, you'd save that part of the system, you could move on to the more needy.
Mm-hmm.
And we're doing the flip with housing, and I understand why, but it perpetuates that sort of discrimination against, we don't want low-income housing or duplexes mm-hmm. or townhouses in our neighborhood. So I don't know what the answer is, but
well,
I think we're going to make the crisis worse.
Well, I think we're mixing two conversations, and I kind of understand why. Like, part of what we're talking in terms of affordable housing is about the housing. It's not about who is being housed in it.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of the homeless crisis response system, the interventions, the coordinated assessment and screening, the rental assistance, and the case management is being vulnerability based.
Yes.
and barrier based, but I just want to try to draw a distinction in that you know, affordable housing, there's a very clear, as this whole presentation has highlighted, there's a very clear relationship between the availability and access to affordable housing and the rates of homelessness. You know, so I'm not dismissing that linkage, but the homeless crisis, especially in the adult world, you know, the homeless crisis response system, who is targeting and what interventions are being done ER-wise is a different animal, you know, and it's about treatment as opposed to housing, so to speak.
And just to add to that a little bit, you can even take the word affordable off of housing. So
yes.
In this part of the conversation, you know, if I'm a private developer, no government subsidy at all, and I think I can make the most money building a duplex and sell two houses, each at a less cost than the one house, I can't do that. So
right.
we're talking about the rules of the overall housing market that then result in what we're facing in demand for homeless services.
Yeah, and I think from my perspective, you know, commerce is, you know, in our work at the state level is, we're involved in all of these conversations. We administer some document recording fees through our homeless programs that we administer, but we also oversee the Growth Management Act, and so we're involved in communicating with cities and counties about their compliance with the Growth Management Act. And that was a perfect example, you know, that one of the big challenges with HALA, but that's not just a Seattle thing, it's every community. You know, if a city council is looking at, or a county council is looking at, hey, we want to encourage more housing density in a given area, we want to upzone this, that is going to be a scary conversation for a lot of people in that neighborhood. And I know it was for me. You know, I had people canvassing me when my neighborhood was having this conversation. And I think for me, just thinking about, well, wouldn't it be great if my kids could afford to rent in the same neighborhood that I've owned a house in for 10 years? In most communities, that's not possible. Which means that your family needs to go live somewhere else. They don't have the option to live down the street like my grandparents experienced with my parents. So how do we get back to that if we want it? You know, of course, some of our kids want to live on the other side of the state or the other side of the country. That's fine, too. But we want them to find some place that they can afford to rent, right? So I think upzoning is a great example, you know, again, that we can. So and I think the link that I'm trying to make is there are lots of these conversations that I think 10 years ago we might have said, well, that's somebody else's, you know, business. I think from my perspective, if we want to ensure affordability for everybody, getting community action agencies and, you know, getting folks involved in kind of saying, wow, we should probably weigh in on that too, because upzoning a neighborhood to allow more flexible housing has a direct result on affordability, which has a direct result on homelessness.
So, and I guess it's not a question, this is more like an observation or trying to put into context, and I'll quit because we do need to move on to the next presenter. But, you know, things that I'd be thinking about is, you know, 5 years ago, because I've been in a lot of these discussions over the years, what I would have heard from commerce is the need to break
the service stovepipes and the need to, you know, so that the services are more interdependent and the need to change who it is that you're targeting in terms of placing into providing services to and placing into housing, or moving from a housing readiness model to a housing first model. That's not what I'm hearing right now. Okay, what I'm hearing right now isn't, hey, our service delivery system is broken, and that's why we're having this spike in homelessness across the state. What I think I heard was, since we did those focuses in terms of, change that focus and how we're delivering service and doing those homeless intervention, we've seen the homelessness rates across the state, and it's true in Clark County as well, dropped. And then with the housing market change, you know, we've seen an increase. So where is the relationship here? Is the change is not in, oh, we're doing service delivery wrong, and there are always improvements to make, you know, but the fundamental change in terms of what's happening in our community right now that I'm hearing from that is the housing market has changed. So that's why that focus is there.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question? So we manage development with disabilities, and so what I see happening in that community around housing is interesting. The take that the strategies the state's going, but also local families and communities. So, and I think Portland had this thing. We have about 4 or 5 examples where people built tiny homes in the back of their homes, mm-hmm. and so they built in technology, because these are folks with Down syndrome or whatever, so they could be independent. And it's a strategy for them to deal with so that they could teach them in case something happens to the parents. And so they wrap services around it. And I think Portland had something where they were giving them, and that ended though, you could build, what is it called, mother-in-law, yeah. something in the back of their
yeah.
homes or something?
Yeah, mother-in-law or accessory dwelling unit.
Right.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that they're doing to move them out of institutions is they're going in and doing houses, and they have providers who, and the state's helping to pay for this because it's cheaper than putting them in Ferncrest or Rainier. And you have like 2 or 3 of them in a home, and so they have funds to help pay some rent, but they have 24/7 kind of staffing support, and they live in the community, and they teach them, and the neighborhood knows about them and stuff. And so their strategy for how they're addressing this is different. I was interested in your thoughts on some of that.
It's a little different. I mean, in a way, I guess, so I used to be a job developer at Morningside in Thurston County for people with disabilities. So I would pick a client up at an adult family home setting like you've described and take them to a job interview, you know, as part of my work. I think that in a way, that looks like permanent supportive housing, right, in kind of homeless world lingo. I think is the closest comparison, although I think there's also more of a long-term link to funding that people with disabilities have that somebody who is experiencing homelessness might not have, right? So unless that person who is homeless is also has a long-term disability, in which case, again, the services thing might link up. I think the challenge is, or what's happening is, the cost of living continues to increase. The dollars that we have in services is not keeping pace. So I think we'll have to keep innovating in every community on how do we help as many people as possible get independent. How do we partner, you know, with private landlords to get more people into private units? We can pay rent. We don't have to own the property. We don't have to build a property. And then we're able also to save a finite amount of resources for permanent supportive housing. So people who we know have long-term housing needs can live in permanent supportive housing and have longer-term services and supports.
And with that, we do need to get rolling along. Do we have one more quick question? Or?
Well, I was just going to say that workshop mm-hmm. that we went to talked about how, this is the level up from homelessness, mm-hmm. that maybe a new developer says that they have to do 5 units out of their thing that the government, that will subsidize,
to create affordable housing for somebody who might not have, but they're mixed in with everyone else, and there is some support for the developer to encourage that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, so maybe 5 units out of 30, they have some support.
And that was also included in, I know that's been in a couple of plans that I've seen around the state. I know that was part of HALA. But yeah, I mean, that's a great tool. And again, it's a private market solution. So it's requiring, you know, sometimes with a development incentive, you'll offer an extra floor or two. You know, the height restriction for commercial may be, you know, 3 stories or 4. But if you're doing housing, you may get bonus floor if you're doing, you know, so there's other ways to incentivize. You know, maybe you can even do more housing or more floors if you're doing an affordable, you know, X amount of affordable units. So there's lots of tools like that. And again, it's a private, that's, I think, a private market solution or support that'll help us all serve more people with finite public resources.
Excellent. Gary, thank you so much for coming down, making the trip, and for sharing so much valuable information with us. We all greatly appreciate it. Very informative. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
We'll move along to Andy, who should be a stranger to none of us.
Unfortunately. You heard that.
Forward, backwards.
Thanks. All right, so I got tasked with talking about the state of homelessness in Clark County, working off that wonderful presentation. And I'm supposed to keep it pretty high level, so I'll do my best. When I used to do these, I talked about a lot of things before I got to any numbers around homelessness, and everyone hated it, and they kept, the first question I always got was how many people are homeless. So, because I'm a crowd pleaser, the title of this slide is very important. It does not say how many people are homeless in our community. I don't know the answer to that question. I could give you a number. There are 19 different ways to count. Every number is different. So what I'm trying to do instead is give a sense of the scale of homelessness and what we're currently dealing with as a community and as a crisis response system. The first number you see up there relates to our coordinated assessment, which in our community is the Housing Solutions Center, and the number of families and individuals who have come to us who we know are homeless, who have done an assessment, but have we've not been able to connect to the resource that we know that they need to end their homelessness. And I'll talk more about what those words mean as we get into it. But as you can see, they're sort of staggering numbers. It used to be that I got a lot of questions about why are the school numbers so high. You know, in the last school year, when you look at just the biggest 3 districts, Vancouver, Evergreen, and Battleground, the number, I think, was about 2,700 homeless students. And people would ask, how come in our point-in-time count, you know, the number's so much smaller? And, you know, well, one of the reasons is that there's a different definition used in the school system. Well, which is true, but I also think that sometimes the school numbers are a leading indicator of different things going on in the community. Sometimes they're a leading indicator of new languages that are being spoken, about demographic changes. I think over the last couple of years, the increases we've seen in the school population, we're now seeing reflected in our homelessness system as well. Another metric to kind of take a look at, that second one, the number of families and individuals requesting emergency shelter. So that first number, 496, if it's a family of 5, they're counted once. And these are all unduplicated numbers over the course of the year. And you can see below the percentages of the families and individuals that were actually able to place an emergency shelter. So you get a sense, again, of the scale. And this last one, I stuck it in there just because these numbers still, even though I do this work all the time, in our community, these numbers still shock me a bit. And that last one is the new day center that opened about a year ago. Share operates it. It's at the Friends of the Carpenter location. And it's and this is not in any way a criticism, but it is a relatively bare bones day center. There, some of the plans to put some resources there weren't able to materialize, so it's going to be moving, but there aren't showers, you know, but there are resources there for people. In about 1 year, 968 different people went to the day center to access services. This is not a place that, you know, families with kids would go. You know, this is relatively high needs folks living outside that would access this day center. That's a huge number. So it gives a sense of the scale. Why? Well, yes.
Can we sort of surmise from that we have 1,000 people living outside in our county?
Well, these are not, so these numbers, none of these numbers are looking at sort of that point in time count. The what on today, how many people are living outside? The reason for that, one, and I didn't include the point in time numbers. There are a couple reasons for that. One is we're about to do one, so the numbers I would give you are almost exactly a year old at this point. Two is we do the point in time because we have to. It's the way the federal government, and because of the federal government, the state, and others track trends. It is not an accurate, it's a way to track trends. It is not an accurate count. We know that we're undercounting. You know, we know that it's just a floor. We theoretically, you know, through query and assessment, could determine on any given day how many people, but it's just not as black and white as we think about it. So you've got that family of five, the husband sleeping in a car, two kids are doubled up at that person's house, who are you counting? So when it comes to the reality of the situations people are living in, I find it's a little bit easier to think about the numbers in this way. If you were to push me, I would guess on any given night, maybe 500 people are sleeping outside, you know, give or take 200.
Hey, Andy, one last numbers question, for me at least. The 496 families and 1,482 individuals, are those mutually exclusive, or are those 1,482 individuals may also be part of those 496 families?
Those are the family. You'd add those two together to get the total number.
Okay, thank you.
So you'd add if you want number of people, you'd add the number of people in the families to the individuals. If you want a household, you just add those two together. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Andy, quick question.
Yeah.
Does these numbers include the sobering center? Because we have a lot of homeless people who go into that sobering center.
They only, so we have a connection with the sobering center to do assessments and things, so it's only counting the people at the sobering center who are also touching our system. So, you know, they call us and say, we have somebody, can you do an assessment? So once that connection is made, they'd be counted, but they would not be, it's not, there are many different systems that have some data point around homelessness. It's not including any of those unless they've also touched our system.
So we probably have uncounted folks in other systems.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and this is, and part of the reason I'm giving, you know, a couple different ones is like, so not all of these people, right, are going to be, have access services, you know, so, and then not everyone requests shelter, although that's probably the biggest request that we get. So, I mean, there's overlap between the three, but there's also, you know, it's just multiple ways to work. Yeah.
I've sent a lot of calls to your phone number. I work reception now, and I send the calls there at people who have received eviction notices, have to be out in so many days. Would any of those be counted here?
No.
Not yet homeless.
No, that and those would be far bigger numbers. So to give a sense of the volume, so we don't even have the capacity to enter those calls into our HMIS database. That's how many of those calls we get. So we would only enter somebody in if they were served. And I think it's been about 8 months since any of our partners had funding for that came through us. So for whatever those months have been, all those calls, we say, I'm sorry, try St. Vincent de Paul, and do you want us to help think through a plan for you if it doesn't work out? Big numbers.
Indeed. this is why you don't start with numbers. But it happens. This is what I'm saying. There's no good way to do it. It would happen anyway. I could start with any slide, and it would come back to the numbers. So obviously, we just got a large presentation that was wonderful on a lot of the why on the housing market side. You saw in that slide where Clark County fit in, and it was bad. We were, I think, tied on that for the lowest vacancy rate. So that is a big drive. That would, in our opinion, is the primary driver of the numbers that we're seeing. But I also want to point out the population growth, because I think a little bit later on we'll talk about some myths around homelessness. One myth around we tend to think about homelessness as static. Like, there are, you know, a number of people who are homeless, and they've been homeless, and they're going to be homeless, and one of them's named Joe, and I see him on my way to work. And when you think of it that way, it's sort of, this is weird, because then it's disconnected, you know, it's about other things than maybe the housing market, and it's not necessarily related to population growth. But in actuality, it's really mostly about, you know, if you think about it as sort of, you've got the housing market here, and what people, you know, these are all the different prices of housing, and then the incomes are what people can afford. As the housing prices go up, if the incomes don't get up, that gap is homelessness. And as the gap gets bigger, homelessness grows. And population growth is both one of the drivers of our booming housing market, because we have a net migration to the Pacific Northwest, and we have a net migration within the Portland metro region to Southwest Washington, which both are good potentially for the community overall, but not good for housing prices. And we are, as a community, sort of growing up a bit. We're going from maybe a more small town feel to a little bit more urban feel, and with that come larger numbers.
Is that population, was that Clark County or what?
Yeah, sorry. This is this is Clark County.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep. And that was the latest number that I could find. It's an estimate, you know, until we do the 2020 count. Okay, so we talked about the scale of homelessness. What about what is it like to be homeless in our community? So on the top here, this didn't really come out. This is supposed to be a sleeping bag to the right. But you know, I have been lucky enough in my life never to experience homelessness. But the way that I think about it, and through working with people and conversations I've had, is one, if the easiest way for me is if you're one way is if you're a parent, is to think about raising your child in a car. This is a real easy one for me right now because I have a 3-year-old. So you just take that last time that your 3-year-old was really ornery, which for me is, I don't have to think back too long, and you imagine just that family unit, that parenting, that whatever you're trying to do, just keep your head above water and doing it 24/7 in a vehicle, right? The kid's sick. You're in your vehicle. It's 20 degrees tonight. You're in your vehicle. You got in a fight with your wife, and you just want to have 2 minutes to yourself, and you're all in the vehicle. You're an individual, and you're trying to, you know, you're trying to keep your job, but you don't have a place to shower on a regular basis. You don't have regular access to the toilet. I haven't even gotten yet to any behavioral health issue, right? We haven't even brought in a challenge of bipolar or schizophrenia, or maybe I didn't before I was homeless, but now I started using just to try to make it through the night to stay up because I don't feel safe. Or maybe I'm the one, it's my night to stay awake in the car, so that we know that the kids are going to be okay. So it is
it takes a tremendous amount of work just to survive and be homeless. When you start trying to add to that getting a job or keeping a job or getting your kid to school and having them get a good night's sleep and do their homework, you have to be Superman in order just to keep your job. Yeah.
And my brother and sister-in-law have experienced that over the last 12, 13 years. And right now, they're living in a travel trailer in my driveway that my brother remodeled. I give them free access to the house, but still, they were living at somebody else's house that they did not have free access to, raising a preschool young school-ager,
right.
And I can't even imagine that because I've never been close to homeless, but it's amazing how though my brother and sister-in-law have managed to survive and be creative with what they have, but still, I keep trying to get them to come in the house because there's room, but they
right.
just, they're so used to that, being on the edge and, you know, is it going to work? Is it going to last? And so, yeah, they live in a travel trailer. And
yep.
That's their life. And, every time if they go somewhere else and they get kicked off the property, I let them come back to my home because I don't want to see my 9-year-old niece not be in school and not have a place to go to take a shower or have a fridge to put milk in.
Yeah, well, you bring up a couple good points. One is that we often talk about people experience homelessness as being very vulnerable, which of course there's a lot of truth to that, but it's in some ways there's some of the strongest people I've ever met are homeless because you're not going to make it very long if you're not. So when we talk about vulnerable, we certainly don't mean weak, right? Because it takes so much strength just to make it. And then when it this is the biggest issue with being homelessness and talking about sort of the state of homelessness in our community is where can you be? That's the issue of the day. And what we, it depends where you are in the community, but generally the answer is not a lot of places. And that's a real problem. So I could own a piece of property that nothing's there and there are people camping on it. When I say camping, I don't even like to use the word. Sleeping, we should say, because camping makes it sound fun, right? There are people sleeping there because they have nowhere else to be, and I don't mind. I'm the property owner. I don't mind. That's illegal. The police or the sheriff's office or whatever will move you along. If you're in a park, it's illegal because we have rules against sleeping in parks. In the city of Vancouver, there's a new rule that you can sleep overnight on public land, but there's only so much limited public land that isn't a park. So just finding a place to park your car, your camper is half the battle.
Well, and what's so hard about it is my brother works full time, plus he works side jobs, but rent is just out of there. They would never be able to gather up all of the fees that places have attached them now. And they would never be able to pay that rent of $1,200 or more a month just for a little two-bedroom. And I think that's what frustrates my brother and I both, is he works full-time, and it's not within their income bracket to get housing, no matter how hard he tries.
Right, and when we talk about things like rapid rehousing and the housing first model, a lot of it rests on the data that we have now and the experiences we have now, that the best way to help someone increase their income is to have them have a stable place to live, right? So if you have that stability and you're not worried about survival, then you're in a much better position to take advantage of some of our workforce partners and increase your income. Some myths. And these are somewhat deeply held, both, and this isn't something that's just in our community, this is anywhere I've ever been, One is that most people choose to be homeless, and there are different forms of these, right? So it's one that I hear a lot is, you know, there are all these nonprofits that do good work that I hear about all the time. You know, there's Council for the Homeless, and there's SHARE, and there's Second Step, and there's Impact Northwest, there's Community Services Northwest, and there's PIC. So obviously, if I see anybody outside, that's because they want to be outside. You know, they're not availing themselves of any of those services. Well, you know, we know from the numbers, these are of the people who are calling and requesting help. And you can see, and this, and by the way, when you say, when you see 30% of families that needed emergency shelter got it, that doesn't mean they got it the night they called, right? We might, it might have taken us 8 months to get them into, and that, that goes into a positive in that 30%. So we know that in reality, even though there are, just the fact that there are services in the community doesn't mean they're available to someone when they need it, right? Those are two different things. And right now we have a major capacity issue. Another part of this myth is, what does it mean to choose, right? So if in the old days we'd send out a outreach worker and they'd say, you know, hey, if you can quit drinking and you can clean up and get a job, I might have a transitional housing option for you, right? And then the person's like, I'm good. And we're like, he's good. He's choosing to be homeless, right? Well, what are we offering? You know, are we really giving someone a reasonable opportunity? It's very hard to quit drinking. It's a lot harder to quit drinking when you're sleeping outside in cold weather, in the winter, in the woods, and trying to do all those different survival things. So part of tackling this myth is around sort of if we're really giving people what they need and meeting them where they are, what kind of choices are they making? And in my experience, the vast, vast, vast majority of people would choose an apartment and housing with almost no exceptions. The second one, these, you'll read, this is in law enforcement sometimes, you'll read in the Columbian, people use the word transient interchangeably with homeless. Words matter. There are connotations that come with transient. It makes people think that it's somebody from somewhere else, that they're passing through. It gets back to the sort of choosing, you know, like the old sort of, oh, maybe he's riding the rails, you know, like the olden days. The numbers in our HMIS system, the vast majority of people, something like 83, 84% of folks who touch our homelessness database over the course of the year have a last known permanent address in Clark County. And that's not saying that the other ones necessarily are all from away, because they might have a last known address at California, but that was 5 years ago, you know? I moved here 5 years ago, you know? So it's that when we compare the numbers in the homelessness, what we see to the population at large, there are actually greater numbers of people who are homeless who haven't moved here as recently as the population at large. And then the last one, and this I think really is a survival tool of people who are housed. And it's, how do I get myself to walk to my office past the person on the street and not just start crying? And how we do it is we try to think of reasons that it's their fault, right? They did something. They made a bad choice. And I'm not going to stand here and say that everyone who's homeless has never made a bad choice, but I dare anybody in this room to raise your hand who's never made a bad choice. I mean, it's like, you know, one of the things that we do sometimes in case management is, you know, when you're poor, when you're homeless, other people are so involved in your life, you know, and they look at all the choices you make, and they look at all, and we say, oh, why'd you make that choice rather than Well, just think about your own life and the own choices you make. You know, I have a gym membership to 24-hour fitness. I haven't been in 11 months. I pay every single month. It's ridiculous, right? I just have to go there and cancel it.
We should have a meeting and talk about
it. I know, right? Like, I could, with some case management, I could get over that hurdle. So what does our crisis response system look like in Clark County? And I split this up into two parts, because when we're talking about what life is like, the immediate experience of homelessness, again, is one of survival. And we can't ignore that. And we can't ignore it right now where we have, when we're so overwhelmed with some of the capacity issues. So, you know, this is a big change for the Council for the Homeless. In years past, we very often would say things like, we can't put any new investment into emergency shelter. All new investment has to be in housing, because the amount of emergency shelter you need is completely dependent on how well you're preventing people from becoming homeless and how quickly you're moving people out. I still think that's a true statement, and I also, now we have, as an organization and through our board, changed course and say we need more of both. And the reason for that is a lot of what we've been talking about is that the homelessness system is a crisis response. We actually don't get to control the demand for our services. There are things that we can get involved with. There are policy discussions that we can be a part of. But because of that, for the foreseeable future, we're looking at some severe capacity issues, and we can't ignore those basic needs. So at the same time, you know, keeping people alive is obviously hugely important. You know, we've seen, unfortunately, a couple of deaths already this winter on the other side of the river with the cold weather. But we have to also invest in those housing resources to quickly move people out of homelessness and back into their own housing. This is purposefully overstated to prompt discussion, so don't go sharing this around in written form without me explaining. But this is and Michael, I think when you were talking between the two presentations, sort of alluded to this. You know, I get the question a lot. People see the homelessness crisis right now and say, "What's your new strategies? What are you guys going to do different?" I have to sort of laugh to myself a little bit, because it's like, what's the answer to that? You know, we're going to start building boats instead of houses. You know, there's only, on some level, this gets real simple. Like, we have housing, we figure out what you need, we have one place people go, we say, are you just need a little bit of help and you're going to be okay? Do you need a lot of help? And then we connect with the right housing program, right? So the problem isn't that our programs don't work. And I don't mean the Council for Homeless, I mean the whole community. And I'm not going to get into program by program, and although, you know, you all do that as a CAB, but when you look at the success rates of the different housing models, they're pretty good. Does that mean there's never room for improvement? Of course not. We can always do better. We can always keep, you know, making sure that we're investing in the right places. But that's not the big picture thing that's going to get us out of this mess. Is it that we need to coordinate our work more closely together? And of course, you know, we're a little overstated. Of course, there's always room for improvement. But no, we work in the homelessness system. We work incredibly closely together. You know, we have a system set up where one agency determines who's going to be served and how they're eligible for another agency's programs. Like, that's sort of unheard of in social services. That's how closely together we work. That's not the overarching problem.
Andy,
yeah.
Are you doing work with developmental disabilities behavior? I know you're working on behavioral health, but there's 18 behavioral health providers. I mean, are you guys coordinating with these other larger systems?
Yeah, and that's right. So that's why I say,
that,
like,
should be more of a soft note. I think maybe there's more that could be done there.
And to be honest, one of the reasons I started was saying I purposely overstated this is when I walked in the room, I was like, crap, Vanessa's there. She's going to bring up behavioral health. And, so, yes, granted. But I think that gets, see where I'm going with this, and I think that ties back in. And then the last one, and we talked about this in the myth, but there's this idea that it's like, oh, it's that we have such good services, and that's why we have a homelessness problem. You know, we just attract everyone. And I think all you got to see is, like, first of all, that's just not true. That's not how the world works. I don't know how else to explain it. But even if it were, like, why are they coming here, you know? Why are they, if you can't get into shelter here and we can't, like, what about that would attract all these folks? So where I'm going with this is that it is a problem of scale. The scale of homelessness in our community and the scale of our crisis response system are just wildly out of whack right now. That's from an emergency needs perspective, that's from a housing perspective, that's from everything. And the reason, this might seem like a simple point, but that this is where the conversation needs to be around in order to solve it. And there are two pieces to that. We've talked about one already, which is how do we lessen the need for the crisis response system? Affordable housing, tenant protections. I often don't even like to use the word affordable because I think people think of a specific, you know, they think of a public housing or it's just housing. How do we build more housing in the community in different, you know, ways that meet what people need who live here? And how do we build the capacity of our crisis response system? And when we get to that conversation, I think, and start saying, well, where are the opportunities? One big one with our partners at the City of Vancouver is the Affordable Housing Fund and the rollout of that. Another huge one is health reform and the Medicaid benefit for supportive housing and other partnerships with behavioral health that are rolling out. But in general, we just need to come together as a community and say, you know, if we're in agreement that it's a capacity problem, then we have to have the conversation of, well, what do? Where are these resources going to come from? How long is this going to last? Are we willing to tackle the underlying problems? Because if not, we're going to need a whole lot more money spent down here. And ideally, obviously, we'd be working in both domains. So that's it.
Excellent timing, Andy. And with that, we do need to move along, but Andy, thank you so much for the detailed presentation. I know we're all looking forward to the board that we have assembled, that Rebecca's assembled in the next hour or so to chat with us about a lot of important things. So I'll turn it over to Rebecca.
Fantastic. So we have a great panel, members on our panel, and I would like to invite them up to the front up here, and if you haven't had a chance to sign in our sign-in sheet, Janet would love me to make sure that I remind you to please sign at it. And then we have some questions that we have forwarded to the panel members in advance so that they can, they would be prepared for this discussion. Appreciate it. And I'll I'm just going to sit over here, so I'm kind of out of the way for you guys. So the executive team a few months ago had said, you know, we really want to learn more about the homeless system, what's going on in our community, what's going on at the state level, what can we do as an advisory board, and they just really wanted to have a big discussion about homelessness. As you know, it's purview of the advisory board to oversee the document recording funds and the consolidated homeless grant and emergency services grant, you know, all these homeless funds. And they so they asked if we could put together a panel, and we wanted to bring in people that we really knew had a different view as far as where they are in our community. So I'd like to let you introduce yourselves and what you do in our community, and then we can move on to the first question.
I'm Sharon Pessett. I work for Partners in Careers, and basically we help people get back to work and then stay employed. So We work with all ages, youth through seniors, and just try to tap into any way we can to get them employed. And simple as that, I guess.
And I'm Carrie Redland with the Department of Commerce.
I don't know if I actually remember to introduce myself, so I'm Andy Silver with the Council for the Homeless.
I'm Bunk Morin with Community Services Northwest.
Clark County Councilor Julie Olson. I also am currently, this may change, on the Council for the Homeless and the Urban County Policy Board.
Great. I'm Ann McInerney Ogle. I served with some of you as a CAB member. I'm the Mayor Pro Tem for the City of Vancouver.
So our first question, the state data shows that despite Washington State's efforts resulting in an overall decrease in per capita homelessness of more than 17% since 2006, homelessness has been increasing since 2013. How is your agency helping to decrease the number of people living on the streets or at risk of homelessness?
Okay, just going right down the line?
We'll go right down the line.
So at Partners in Careers, we have the opportunity to work with many people who are homeless or at risk of homelessness. So the four ways that we really are trying to address that is, one, we help our staff understand what the resources are in the community so they can make those direct connections. If our staff understand what's out there, they certainly can help educate. And then more than just educate, help them actually take those steps to access those resources, the key piece. We do make direct referrals to the Council for the Homeless. It's probably a daily dial for many of our staff on trying to get people connected to what's out there. We help participants stay housed by giving them case management. And a lot of that is, you've heard a lot of people are doubling up. So they're living with family members, I believe, is as you mentioned. And one of the challenges we have is that's such a tenuous situation. So at any moment, they could have a fight and be removed. And we see that, especially with our youth. They have a fight with mom. Mom says, you're gone, be gone, don't come back. And you're like, what do you do as a 17, 18, 19-year-old? So we work with staff to help deal with those family dynamics or roommate dynamics or landlord dynamics, whatever those are, because if we can keep them housed by helping them learn how to have those relationships and communicate, it really does hopefully help take the stress off the rest of the system. And then lastly, we are getting people employed and more importantly, keeping them employed and helping them understand what it's going to take to do that. And while that's not the end all, it does, if you're employed, it really does help you find a place to live.
I talked about this a little bit after my presentation, and I'm sorry, I'm kind of an absent-minded professor. Sometimes I just sat down and started chatting, and I forgot about our panel, so I apologize. But I think at the state level, some things that I haven't talked about today, for the first time ever this year, we got the affordable house. There are a number of governor-appointed councils and commissions that the Department of Commerce staffs that influence statewide affordable housing policy, homeless services policy, and for the first time ever, we got all those councils together at the same time over the summer and started broader conversations about homelessness and affordable housing and those linkages. So having it at a state level, the same conversation that I tried to get going today. Debunking myths, I think, is a lot of work that we also try and do among agencies and our peers, with state agencies and funders, but also at the legislature. And of course, speaking of the legislature, document recording fees is a cornerstone for how we do these services, right? And that conversation about, should we fund document recording fees? Those fees start to sunset in 2019, which means we'll be having that conversation again this year. I'm looking down the table at electeds because you all have a lot of influence over your state legislators. Mm-hmm. And
you think?
depends on which one.
conversations about what do those fees mean and how who spends them and who do they go towards and what the world in your community would look like without those fees, I think will pay dividends for at least maintaining the services that we currently have. And then the other thing that we've been really working on at the state level is adjusting our contracting and encouraging, incentivizing services so that we're focusing on making sure that the most vulnerable are being served and identified first.
Sort of first, I guess, from a more of a direct service viewpoint, we've We've implemented what we call diversion. So we've put a lot of effort at the Housing Solutions Center into identifying families and individuals who might not need a full-on housing program run by one of our partners, and seeing if with some light staff support and housing navigation, we can kind of quickly rehouse them and leave our partnering programs to work with folks who are of higher need and vulnerability. And then we've just tried to work a lot more in the housing policy area. So I know more about zoning than I ever thought I would or really want to, but really sort of trying to work upstream a bit more as an organization in trying to reverse some of the trends that we've been talking about.
So for those of you who don't know about Community Services Northwest, we're a large behavioral health organization. We're very similar to Columbia River Mental Health or Lifeline as far as what we do. We probably work on this issue in five very tangible ways. One, we're a landlord, so we have 12 units of housing that are earmarked basically to serve low-income individuals. We also have various housing programs through HUD or the Department of Commerce in some cases, or other county contracts where we have around 100 subsidies to help also low-income individuals obtain private units in the community. And we provide case management that supports that, the relationship with the landlord or building tenancy skills, that kind of a thing. We also have one of the three homeless outreach teams in the community, or four homeless outreach teams. That it's a co-occurring outreach team that goes around encampments and finds people in the woods or in the street or wherever they may be to try to get them connected to whatever resource they may need. What is the fourth one? There's a fourth one. I've lost it. I participate on the local steering committee as a behavioral health representation to give feedback about how those systems could better work together. And then we're also working very closely with the healthcare authority, giving feedback on the new Medicaid waiver supported housing that's coming out, the Low Income Housing Alliance, to help them craft the most effective way to put that in place and operationalize it so that there's more healthcare dollars going towards providing supportive services around people who are eligible for them. So in addition to that, those are the sort of the concrete ways. Our organization, I think, is unique amongst the ones that are similar to us in that we have over 100 employees. Over half of them do the bulk of their work in the community, meaning it's not clinic-based. So we have mental health counselors located in all of the share shelters and open house ministries, providing the services on site there full time. We have substance abuse counselors in those clinics or in those shelters as well. We have counselors in the schools. We have a lot of counselors who go see people in their homes versus having them come into the clinic. And we set it up that way intentionally so that people have get the care they need, when they need it, how they need it, from whom they need it, rather than having them have to march into a clinic that may not be the appropriate setting for whatever reason. We still do clinic-based stuff for those individuals that will be best served that way, but we are a very community-based service model. So
the county, just vis-a-vis our function, really finances the majority of the crisis response system in Clark County through Vanessa's department and Michael Torres. So about $4.5 million a year of the county general fund, through those systems. And then this general fund is about $247,000 a year that goes toward funding our human services fund. We also have a 10-year homeless action plan that, as a part of that plan, it requires us to have a continuum of care system, a coordinated entry system, an assessment system, which you've heard a little bit of discussion about today, and an annual point in time count, which is coming up soon. And we've also adopted the Housing First model, which we've heard about this morning too. So so in terms of reducing homelessness, trying to get it under control, the county is a very big player in that regard and committed to doing that. So those are the folks that do the hard work over there though.
For the city of Vancouver, of course, you probably have heard about our affordable housing proposition one. But that came as a result of the task force that we started, and with the help of our staff, Peggy Sheehan, we spent quite many, many months identifying some of the problems and some of the possible solutions, and that was just one of them. We expanded that no clause time from 20 to 30. We extended when the landlord can give you a rent increase, and that discrimination of funding for those so that you can use those vouchers as part of your funding for your rent and such. But we have a variety of housing. You heard about accessory dwelling units. I have the first legal one. The city of Vancouver allowed it in 1990. They're all over the place. And what makes them different from a lot of other small apartments is that three-prong plug-in for the oven. But how many of our young people are actually cooking with an oven now? So those are some of the things that we're looking at. Do we expand and change the accessory dwelling units? We have duplexes everywhere. That's not a problem for the city of Vancouver. So all of those housing and the quality of housing and where they are and multifamilies, they're all throughout the city of Vancouver. You've seen them, you know where they are and that sort of routine. But we also have very small apartments, studio apartments, and even smaller ones. So part of our discussion is inclusionary zoning, and can we put even smaller ones in some of those you can have a three-bedroom and you can have a 600. So we're having that discussion. We also give tax abatements. And Peggy gave us some great numbers over the, since we've been giving tax abatements, we've had 21 requests for tax abatements. 16 were approved, 5 are in process right now. 3 of them are already done and moved on. Now they're paying taxes on those. 3 are renting, 5 in construction, a total of nearly 1,900 units. Right now, we've streamlined our permitting system. We have nearly 3,800 units in the application process right now. You talked about, you know, raising that market, getting that market up. That's what we're doing. So mixed use is a type of zoning where you can have your retail on the bottom and your living up above. And in some communities, that's not wanted. We have it in the city of Vancouver.
Thank you all. Okay. Awesome. So the next question is going to pertain to tenant protection, so I want to give a little bit of background. So recently, major cities in Washington have created tenant protection ordinances to help ease renter burden in incredibly tight rental markets. One key ordinance the city of Vancouver passed last year makes it illegal for landlords to discriminate based on a renter's source of income. Due to this ordinance being in place, landlords in the city of Vancouver who rent to households with Section 8 or VASH vouchers may apply for a commerce-coordinated landlord mitigation program that lessens their out-of-pocket costs should a tenant move out and leave damages and or unpaid costs. Carrie?
Yes.
Are landlords using the new commerce landlord mitigation program? What was the impetus for this legislation?
So to start from the beginning, part of what inspired the legislation is was it 2 or 3 years ago, the last time there was a statewide conversation with the legislature about renewing document recording fees, landlord associations and advocates for landlords asked for provisions to be added to that statute when it was passed. So a requirement that document recording fees be audited, that there be a certain percentage of document recording fees that go to private market units. And also, I think people around the state started talking and thinking on, well, what could we do to encourage to incentivize not only more private market landlord engagement, which is another statewide challenge. I mean, we hear around the state there are lots of reasons why landlords don't necessarily want to rent to somebody either with specific types of sources of income, you know, generally government sources of income, Social Security or a housing voucher, something else. So what are ways that we could kind of start to bridge, create incentives, and link to work that communities are doing to break down some of those barriers to housing?
because of course all over the state we hear stories about, a person has a voucher, they can't find a place to rent a unit. So this was an incentive to link, right, that the voucher with a landlord, and help break down some of the myths or stereotypes around, I'm afraid that person might damage my unit, or what if. The program has been in place now about a year, well, a little bit less than a year, but we have not provided any funds to any landlords yet. We've also not gotten any applications yet, as of today. We have turned down two applications from, I'm smirking a little bit, it's not funny. We've turned down two housing authorities who requested support. They don't qualify because they're not a private market landlord. And the target, the hope was to grow, encourage, provide a support system for private market landlords who might otherwise be reluctant. So this is a tool in a toolbox for somebody who's out trying to develop relationships with landlords to get folks who have a voucher or some other source of income that traditionally has had a hard time getting a unit into a unit. So it's another tool for them. So
can I ask a question? How long has the city of Vancouver had the ordinance for the tenant protections?
Just October.
Okay, so it's fairly
But
new.
We haven't had any. We use our volunteer lawyers in Northwest mm-hmm. Justice, and no complaints have been turned in.
October of 2015, so a little over.
Oh, so it's been a year.
Yeah, a little over a year.
You're right. You're right. I'm a whole year behind. Yeah, because we just did. We're in 17 now. Yeah. Sorry.
Hard boys.
Yeah, sorry.
But let's, I think, I think we're interested in, if there's things that we could do to publicize the program better, if that's part of the problem. I know at the state level, statewide organizations who represent landlords are aware of the program.
We had lots of landlords come to testify at the task force that there were problems, timing, and they weren't getting paid. The vouchers were so slow, they weren't getting their rent in a timely manner and that sort of routine. And there was just an article in the Columbian, maybe you saw it, about the woman who is having difficulties with her vouchers.
So Councilwoman McInerney-Ogle, what effect have the new tenant protection ordinances had in the city?
Well, as I said, we don't know that they've had. We continue to get responses from folks about how much time they have for a no-cause eviction. And we haven't heard from the discrimination, that article in the Columbian about the discrimination piece isn't discrimination. The landlord can ask for three times your income, but that's not discrimination because you have a voucher. They're doing it for others also. And we haven't heard anything. Peggy, have you heard anything on the percentage of increase of rent? Have people come forward with any complaints yet?
The landlords are following the rules, and what is interesting is it's leaked over to properties outside of the city. So we get calls from other landlords, like in Hazelville and other places that have adopted this policy.
But the Northwest Justice Project and those volunteer lawyers haven't come through with anything.
Well, that's
so
good.
Maybe it's working.
Yeah. Councilwoman Olson, has the county had any discussions about implementing anything similar to the ordinances passed by the City of Vancouver? Do you consider this politically feasible? And are there pros and cons from your view?
To date, we have not had any discussions about any tenant protections or rental policies, frankly. What was the second part of the question?
Do you consider this politically feasible?
We are one of the most urbanized counties in the state. Unincorporated Clark County is city-like. Mm-hmm. So is it politically feasible?
I'm taking that as a yes.
You know, have you heard about this mitigation fund?
Well, and full disclosure, I am a landlord, so I appreciate both sides of. I have Section 8 tenants. And we were talking the other day. It's not so much about where the money comes from. It's about the tenant, and landlords should always have the right to be able to make sure their tenant is going to be somebody who takes care of the property without regard to where the money comes from. So that's the landlord speaking. So I don't know. I don't know if it's politically feasible with the current with what's on our plate right now in the county. It doesn't mean that it's not. I think the case has to be made for the landlord side of the equation as well. And I think all things equal, if landlords still have the right to make sure that they rent to folks who are going to take care of the property and pay the rent on time, then it shouldn't be a big deal where the money comes from. And so that's my personal perspective. Would I go to lobby the council right now? Probably not. But it doesn't mean we can't have the conversations in the background and start the discussion.
Oh, I was just going to add, from a service provider perspective on how it's working in the city of Vancouver, what the source of income protection allows is a conversation, and that has been really invaluable for us and the work that we do. And what I mean by that is that, as you were pointing out, there's nothing about it. You're just the landlord or the property management company just applies the same screening criteria they would to everyone else. There's nothing about it that makes it more likely that somebody with barriers would be able to rent that apartment, except for the fact that what happens without it is that it shuts off even looking at that tenant. So without that protection, people sometimes just say, I don't want to deal with it, no Section 8. Or maybe they think that everyone with Section 8 has a certain level of barrier. So what it allows is that person to apply and for us to explain the program and have the conversation. And we've seen a lot more success because of that ability to have the conversation.
And have you seen landlords get more educated on Section 8 tenants and say, all right, you know what, maybe I was mistaken in terms of the broad brush?
Yes, and I think one of those areas of education is on the... There, like in our homelessness system, there are all these types of rental assistance that aren't Section 8, and if you're not in the business, it all kind of gets lumped together,
sure. Mm-hmm.
And it allows that sort of, well, this is how this program operates, and is this, you know, and it gives that added level of comfort sometimes. It's not a fix-all by any means.
So but, I was thinking, yeah. to finish up on the, I was thinking, Andy, when you were talking, it probably would be, I don't know when the last time you came and spoke to the county council, but I got to thinking this would probably be a nice opportunity for you to come and bring the county council up to date on what's happening around homelessness in Clark County. And
Michael and I are actually coming tomorrow morning, so I'll
good.
We'll see you there.
Good.
Yeah. Exactly
about that.
Right. Not quite about that, but
and,
we can.
And honestly, this is one of the hopes that the executive team had with this discussion was to bring different providers together to then make more connections, to then move the issues that we have for the Community Action Advisory Board up to another level. So this is perfect. Appreciate it. Bunk or Sharon, did you want to add anything to the conversation about tenant protections?
My piece would be more what the benefits are to the clients and much of what Andy said, a lot of times it allows us to have conversations and for tenants to be honest. When we go in on behalf of our clients and they're struggling with a landlord, whether it's because their funding isn't going to come and they're going to be a couple days late on their rent, and we try to help them advocate for themselves, but it's about being able to be honest. And I think a lot of times our clients that are on TANF or some other subsidy they don't want people to know that. I mean, there's a stigma attached to it, right, in some ways. And so we were able to have this conversation. They're able to be a little bit more honest, especially for us if they've got something that has happened in their past, if they have an eviction or they've got a criminal background, and maybe it happened when they were 20 years old and now they're 35 and it's still hanging over their head and they're not able to move forward. And I get the landlord's perspective. I mean, they've got plenty of people to choose from, and so why? We would like to see that extended to if they're being case managed to the points that were made. If someone is actually helping them make sure that they're being a good tenant, they're doing the RentWell classes that are out there helping them learn how to be a good tenant, and people are just going to give them a chance. That's a big piece. The increasing the time of vacate or the rent, really is huge, because most of our families live paycheck to paycheck. And to Andy's point, they don't always make poor decisions on how they spend their money, but they're choosing each month on what they're going to pay and what they're not, if that doesn't balance out, right? And sometimes those are tough decisions. And we could look at what they're spending it on, and we try not to judge. You know, it comes through. We have them go through the exercise. But when you give them 20 to 30 days to have to make a pretty significant change when there isn't flexibility, be like, if my car broke down on my way home today, and please tell me it's not going to do that, I would have the resources to be able to go out and spend a few $100s. And most of these people, that sends them in a tailspin. And when those kind of things have to happen for transportation, for students to school or for them to a job, it has to happen, or they have to find other alternatives. And so as much time as we can give them, and again, the case manager piece, getting them connected to someone that can help, not just to give them the funds. That's important. Those resources are important. But how to use those and leverage those and keep them from, put them in a better place is really where we're at. So those are kind of the key things. And obviously, we are working really hard. Those lengthening times help us prevent them from being homeless. You know, we get those 3-day notice to vacate. We get those calls on a Friday afternoon, and you're like, okay, what do you do? And, you know, we're not a housing agency, and we are grateful to those housing agencies that exist in our community, because we just instantly get in touch with them. And as I said, the staff have really learned what those are. But the more time we can give them, one, it helps them make good choices and not jump from one choice to another choice. They're actually able to have a little bit more time to work that out with some support. Because, you know, I will tell you, I was renting a home, and I was given a 20-day notice. And you know what? I have resources. But I, the first time I heard it, I was like, so now what do I do? How do I pack up my house? And I don't have young kids. It's like, how do I make this happen, right? And I am not homeless. I am far from homeless. And as I said, I have the resources, and we made it work. But there was stress. So think about, if you don't have a job that will allow you to spend time trying to find another place to stay, you don't have the resources. You know, you have to think about kids who have to move from school to school. So now you're moving from one place to another. And let's say you're fortunate enough to be housed. Your kids may be shifting schools. So there's a lot of all those pieces that, you know, happen. You've got to come up with first and last again. You've got to come up with a security deposit. You might have to come up with storage and or moving fees, because maybe you don't have friends that have vehicles, or you don't have the resources to rent a truck. So instantly, this pile, this avalanche of decisions come in a very short order. And so to me, any time we can lengthen that is good news. So I am excited. And our families have already benefited from this. So.
Thank you. The next question is for the entire panel, and we'll start with
Anne. Cut it short.
What are some recent changes outside of the homeless crisis system that have led to or will lead to improvements for the homeless system?
Well, I did pass out to you a couple documents on our day center. So as Andy pointed out earlier, we did have the day center down at Friends of the Carpenter. And those are some numbers, race, ethnicity, what services were provided there. But it has not turned out as well as we want, because it's still in an industrial zone, and it's not, there are no sidewalks to this thing. So Cher wrote an application to the state, and we are working to provide a new day center. I don't know if you've seen this one, Julie. It's across the street from the Cher House next to Lincoln Place. There's a lot there, and you wouldn't think it was very large, but it will work for us. And we can provide a couple different things in there that we can't before. So it's about 3,000 square foot building. It has the opportunity for all of those showers and restrooms and washers and dryers. So Cher wrote it. We're looking to pull in some money from Washington State. City will pitch in. We'll work with Vancouver Housing Authority on that piece. And hopefully we'll get some notification in March on that day center. But we're also working on a number of other different pieces. You probably read about it, but what do we do with people who need to earn a little bit of money? And going around on the Facebook probably about 6-7 months ago was some mayor in some great little place who was handing out money for people who would work. And then they could use it for a number of different things. But that was faith-based money. And so what we did is we took kind of the same concept, and using our solid waste funds, Waste Connections and Share went together to work on it, and PIC jumped in also to help with that, to have a one-year pilot to fund people to help clean up downtown. In fact, I was telling Peggy yesterday, there were about five individuals who were sweeping and cleaning up a section just east of Esther Short Park, but PIC is teaching them some actual skills. They're getting paid. They're helping clean up some of the messes that we have down there, and it's all kind of run by Waste Connections and Share. So it's not city. It's Waste Connections, and we've just allowed them to use some of those funds to make that happen. So it's a one-year project that we're looking at. But we also meet regularly. In fact, Peggy and I will be scooting out here because monthly we meet with what we call the Homelessness Ideas Group, and that is that downtown group to get together. We have everyone here from city staff, neighborhood leaders, businesses, open house ministries, all of the folks from Share and Council for the Homeless, Andy Such, to get together to talk about how are we doing downtown, because that is where the camping is. That is where the car camping, that's where the trash is, that's where folks are feeding in the parks, and are we doing the right things here? Are we allowing the right things? How are we taking care of those who are actually camping and not getting into shelters? For example, the who and the what. But we also have St. Luke's Church just up on Fourth Plain that has opened up a few more spots for women shelter. We have Our Lady of Lourdes, who is converting the convent, which housed single women, into housing single women. And so the Archbishop is waiting. It will make that last decision, but all of the bells and whistles have been taken care of. And again, Cher is jumping in to help with that. And that is actual housing, not temporary, not shelter. And so we have lots of different groups starting up. In fact, we were talking about all the different pieces that we have, the Meadows, Isabella Court, the Vancouver Housing Authority apartment homeownership on D Street is a whole new project coming in. We have the Caples Terrace piece. We have McKibben's Commons. And then there's a permanent shelter task force that is exploring the feasibility of another new shelter. So we're pedaling fast.
Well, I just have to interrupt. I'm just sorry, but Anne, you're a rock star.
Our city,
well,
our staff,
yes.
Our Peggy.
But putting all these things together, that's really what it's all about. So my hat's off.
It is, but it's a real partnership. It's
absolutely
a partnership with the county.
Yeah.
We're at the Council for the Homeless.
Yeah.
We have the Cooper Housing Authority, all those faith-based
yeah.
operations. Everyone has a little space in their basement, and it means that they have to have the confidence to kind of step out and say, yeah, we maybe can do that.
Nice going.
Yeah.
It takes someone to pull it together.
Sure,
it
does. It takes lots of people to pull it together.
It takes one person to get it started.
Yep. Thanks, Boy.
Yep.
So outside the homeless system, you know, I'd say, again, the city of Vancouver's got the biggest bulk of this population, but we're still an urbanized county, so where we have the opportunity to incentivize or to allow through some creative zoning multiple options for housing, I think we need to look a little bit broader at that at the county level. We've had the opportunity to look at ADUs in the rural areas, and we've kind of been sitting on that, and I think we'll bring that back up and take a look at that to help. And then also tiny houses was another one that has come before us, and just because the makeup of the council just sort of stalled out. So that's another one I think we should look at. It'd be simple little code change in terms of square footage to allow for tiny houses in part of the unincorporated areas. So so all of that, in addition to working more closely with the city of Vancouver at the council level, and then also in our community services level, so that we pay attention to what they're doing that's working and where we can incorporate those in the unincorporated areas, but the high population areas, I think, makes sense for us to do. So
if I could add just a hop and a skip between our city limits and the county limits, up on St. James is the Pure Crazy Women's Veterans piece. The Planning Commission approved, and we passed it, the opportunity to rezone a piece for 18 tiny houses, which would be the first. But It was for women veterans. They signed a lease on it for 100 years. The VA is helping with that. And we're not talking, we're talking underground sewer, water, utilities, and the homes are just tinier. But they still have to meet all of the fire marshal's conditions and everything else. They may not have that three-prong plug, but you can do a lot with a convection oven and a microwave and a... yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Rebecca, I just want to, Councilor Olson, with her busy schedule, she might not remember this, but through the budget process, you guys approved a lot of new initiatives to support outside the crisis homeless. So one is through the 1/10 and 1 cent sales tax, funding the access to recovery to help people who are in recovery with rental assistance. We're also using that to support the court systems who are coming out of courts or jails to get them back into housing more quickly. And so there's a direct relationship that we have with them. You support the veterans program with more focus towards the housing.
And more funding.
With some rental assistance. And then also we did a presentation and they supported, which I mentioned to you before, the Merriweather Project. So they're using some other pots of funds to put in towards housing. So I want to thank the counselors for that.
Definitely. Would you like me to repeat the question?
Sure.
What are some recent changes outside of the homeless crisis system that have led to or will lead to improvements for the homeless system?
I guess probably the one I'm uniquely positioned to talk about is the Medicaid waiver. So for those of you who aren't familiar with that, the Washington State just reached an agreement with CMS yesterday in principle to, I don't remember the dollar figure, but it's a lot of money that can go towards a bunch of initiatives, one of which is sort of housing as a healthcare service. There's a lot of details I think they still need to work out, but in a nutshell, people won't have to go through a mental health assessment or a substance abuse assessment, get a counselor, get a referral to maybe have someone help them with housing-related activities. It will be a person is, whatever the criteria is, chronically homeless, X, Y, and Z, straight into a housing specialist who can then work with them on a housing plan. So in that sense, it'll get people in much quicker, right in front of the person they need to see, and allow them to get support around housing. My hope as an organization is that we can leverage subsidies that we can get through other areas or units that we have, along with this ability to use Medicaid for service dollars so that we can expand what we do as an organization. And I'm thinking other organizations are looking at it similarly. Because the challenge in our work is always that you can get subsidies from here, but who are you going to pay to monitor the subsidies and make sure all the paperwork's submitted so you don't get killed on an audit? Or you can have units, but you can't put people with your subsidies in your units. So it's really dependent on these sort of blending things together or working with partners. And I think this Medicaid waiver will be a big cog to allow to partner in that way with subsidies that we have or units or other organizations so that we can provide case management or house tenancy skills to individuals ongoing. So that's probably the biggest thing that I'm involved with.
So does that require mental health diagnosis?
I mean, there's a criteria there's draft WACs that are out, Washington Administrative Code, that sort of spells it out. There's the eligibility that the healthcare authority has put forward as to who would meet the criteria for this. But from someone who does the work, there still is a little bit more detail that has to be put into that to rule people in and out. And I don't think that razor's edge has been established yet. So it's hard to say. I couldn't go out today and say, yeah, that person would meet criteria. That person wouldn't. You could probably guess with some of them. But they haven't gotten that fine level of detail yet, to my knowledge. But yes, they would just come in based on that criteria alone, work with a housing person, not have to engage in any other treatment activities to get to that point. You have to be a licensed DBHR organization, so you can do limited scope. So somebody can, in theory, say, we just want to do Medicaid supported housing and apply for that license. That said, the infrastructure you have to build Medicaid, you know this, the HIPAA requirements for your software, having a billing department, a coder, a mental health professional who knows how to do medical necessity documentation, all that stuff, the scale that someone would have to do it on, to be able to make it work financially is probably going to limit how many non-traditional Medicaid providers pursue this.
I want to clarify that because, I mentioned earlier, I'm working with the Pay Action Agency statewide. So we just found out there are three trackways to get access to that supported housing. but long-term and disability also has this track, so the CAP agencies are probably going to go that route. And then we're meeting with the NCOs, and so they're thinking about what can they do with them with the Medicaid waiver, and also some of their funding to do some social determinants of health. So many of the non-behavioral health agencies will probably have to go through the other tracks.
And ALTSA rolled theirs out early with a pilot program, and SHARE is participating and has a couple people right now, I think, are coming out of Western State that they're going to do a supportive housing thing.
That's great.
And the state's been tracking that really closely, too, at Department of Commerce, and we're excited to get to do some incentives and work both on the operational side with the state-controlled document recording fees in order to incentivize people to take advantage of the waiver, but also on kind of the more capital construction side. So what are links that we can make with developers so that people are applying for housing trust fund dollars with permanent supportive housing in mind, which would link up with the 1115 waiver.
So I guess a question I have, I guess I look to like the middle three, like Andy, Bunk, and Carrie in this. I think it's really exciting, you know, the Medicaid waiver and the resources that may come with that. Not a concern, but how do you see preserving the system for coordinated entry and assessment, which I think has been just vital in having a handle on the community resources and interventions. How do you see preserving that in an environment where to access those resources and supports, you have to have some kind of licensure or linkage to that? You see good methods to preserve that?
Well, to start, so the in each of the different ways to access this benefit, none of the benefit pays for bricks and mortar or rent assistance. So it all has to be tied. It all has to be tied to a pre-existing permanent supportive housing program, whether it's a bricks and mortar site-based or whether it's a scattered site program. So it will, the programs that already work through coordinated assessment, the scattered site or Lincoln Place, for example, would continue to, it would just be basically another funding stream for the services portion, which could free up money in the homelessness system to do more rental assistance.
Mm-hmm.
I think when they were originally looking at the proposals and CMS had put out a guidance of what was in the realm of possibility sort of for 1115 waivers, there was some hope at early on that they'd write it in a broad enough way that coordinated entry and assessment systems themselves might be able to access Medicaid resources for the eligibility determination and the housing search. I don't think that's going to happen under what's moving forward, but it still will be connected to the homelessness system.
So I know our focus is on homelessness here, but if you've got a finite amount of Medicaid dollars, and those dollars in the past have gone to traditional mental health therapies or behavioral health, whatever you want to call it, to what degree are we taking money away from the pure mental health services and allocating them to supportive housing, which is
right.
Critical, so, I know, but I'm just...
So the waiver, and we're not supposed to call it the waiver, the demonstration projects, whatever we're supposed to call it now, are a influx of funding with the idea that it's a temporary and 5-year influx of funding where we'll then use the money smarter to save money and pay for itself. So basically the way this works is the federal government gives us more money,
okay.
We use it for supportive housing, we save Medicaid money by stabilizing people, and then the health plans say, oh, that's smart, I'll just keep doing that in the future.
Okay.
A number of studies around the country, but also from here in Washington, have shown that someone living on the street, unsheltered, and receiving services, is a very expensive person to support. And so if we can get that person housed,
and get them services with as part of their housing linked to the demonstration project, that person will be less expensive both locally and through federal services like Medicaid.
So. And I can connect one more dot on this. Early adopter in the integration of Medicaid financing for primary care, mental health and substance abuse disorders has resulted in a single payer for Medicaid. So any cost savings where it might have before been siloed, so maybe the mental health payer would go, yeah, we're seeing less psychiatric inpatient hospitalizations. And separately, whoever's paying for the ED visits and the medications might have seen, yeah, we're seeing a little less ED visits, and because they're stabilized, formulary expenses, now they're on a generic or whatever, they would have seen that piece. Now the payer sees all of it. So any savings are seen by the same payer for that covered life. So there's more visibility in the healthcare savings costs, theoretically, that could occur because it's a single payer system for that covered life, as where before it would have been the RSN for mental health, the county or private pay for substance use disorders, and a managed care plan for primary care. Now it's all managed care. Molina or Community Health Plan of Washington.
Andy, is there anything else that you wanted to add to the home system discussion?
Yeah, just real quick. So the one thing that we've done is, you know, over the last couple of years, we heard a lot from our partners who have the rental assistance programs that they were having trouble finding private market landlords. And we'd heard criticism from private market developers that, you know, they can do housing cheaper than affordable housing developers. But on the other side, it's not like they're necessarily going out and doing it themselves with a mission purpose. So we decided to put our money where our mouth was, and we've started a company that the Council for the Homeless owns to do housing development. And our goal is to develop housing locally, not using traditional affordable housing dollars that then we can turn around and rent to our service provider partners. So it's outside of the homelessness system, but we hope to have a big impact with the homeless system.
That's fantastic. Carrie?
A lot of great things have been covered. I guess two things that we haven't covered yet. One, I think we are in a relatively good economic spot right now. Wages are up, and I don't know that that's true for Clark County, but I know that unemployment is down. So, which means that there is more economic opportunity for a broad spectrum of people in the community. In any given county in the state, around 80% of our homeless population is working homeless. These are people who may be doubled up, who are working full time. So I think as economic opportunity grows, opportunity for people to get more stably housed hopefully will grow. And I think the other thing that we haven't really touched on yet, but it kind of follows that theme, Rebecca, right? Thank you. Is just, I think, having broader conversations about being real and sharing and talking about, this isn't like another, a foreign, these are people connected to my family, and substance abuse is a real challenge for people in my family and people who I know and I'm connected to. Mental health, these are challenges that we all face. And housing stability is a community challenge for me and my family and people close to me. It's not an other thing. And I think just continuing to have conversations like this in all sorts of circles will also help us make progress.
For us, it's more about WIOA, which I'm sure you've heard about, the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act, really has a focus on serving the most vulnerable workers. And so part of that is also working with education and work. So it's not just like getting people employed, it's about building their skills, because as we know, skills are changing, and really we're training kids in high school now for jobs that don't currently exist. And so how do we keep doing that, and how do we connect that learning and earning at the same time? And so we partner very closely with the Workforce Development Council and the programs that they do. And a cool thing about that connection, that partnership, is not only are we working on the training and the education to build their skills while helping them build their work experience, we're building housing supports inside of programs. So these grants and these programs are funding the ability for us to support these kids as they go through and support the housing agencies that are working on that. So that's a key piece for us. We think that's important. We've also been able to get some pilot money from the Community Foundation to help pay for things like eviction, legal fees for eviction, first and last, security deposits, things that currently our funders, including the Department of Commerce, don't allow us to pay. But the Community Foundation has given us that, and we've been able to take the results of that small amount. In some cases, it's a couple $100s or a couple $1,000s even in the scheme of things in a person's life and ability to be stable. It's a really wise investment, and we're able to be able to show our funders how it's working. And that has even given our partners at the Department of Commerce some opportunity to say, maybe we will be able to add those. So that we're going to be able to change the way that we can support them with the support service dollars we have. And that's really exciting for us because, again, sometimes it's a couple $100s that's keeping them from being able to move forward. And for us, that's really important. I think the bigger thing, as Carrie said, is having those conversations and deepening that understanding in our community about what the connections are. Why does it matter if you have a place to live? Why can't a person who's living in a car get up and go to work? I don't think I need to explain that to you. Andy did a very good job of that. So for us, it's just about making those connections. How does mental health impact? You know, why does it matter if a child goes to school and they don't really know where their parents are going to be? Because, you know, they were in the car last night together, they dropped them off at school, and where are they? Well, I knew where my parents were, at least somewhere in the general vicinity each day, and that's a stressor that our families are under constantly. And so making those connections has been very helpful. So
our final question will be for each of the panel members, and we'll start here with Sharon. What are upcoming advocacy opportunities relating to supporting the needs and resources for people who are low income that CAB members should focus on?
That was a tough one for me. I'm hoping you're going to get some really good answers on that end of the table. So in some ways, I'm glad I'm going first, although I could have gone last and said, yeah, what they said. I think
you can do that preemptively.
What they said. I think the one thing that stuck out as I was thinking, background checks, the screening process that landlords use, you know, especially if there's a length of time. People that have felony records, if for whatever reason, they're just stuck. And fortunately, we have a couple landlords that will look at those. We'll have the conversations, Andy said, and be able to look at them. So if it's 10, 15 years ago. But it's an automatic, I'm sorry, I'll take your $100 application fee, but you have no chance of renting with us. So for us, if that ever came before you and a chance and way to advocate, especially if they're being case managed, you know, that's my wish list. And now what they said.
I think that's a great lead-in to work that we've been involved with at Commerce. So there is a coalition of at the state level agencies that are working on policy changes related to people who have a criminal history, or have experienced incarceration. I mean, there are all sorts of barriers to employment, housing, etc. You've done your time. You're reentering the community, and yet you're hitting all these barriers. You can't find housing. You can't find work because of the conviction, not because of what you were convicted for. You know, so I think on my wish list is, you know, we'll be working with the legislature, and hopefully you all can encourage your legislators to think about how can we have that conversation later in the employer application process, in the landlord application process, so that at least you can get an interview or have a conversation and make your case that not only are you clearly qualified, but, oh yeah, and you saw that thing on my background, and here's my story, and here's, you know, and here's who I am now. Instead of, you know, a lot of employers right now, just that application just goes in the garbage, and then we look at the next candidate. And then, of course, I already brought up document recording fees. That's the biggest source of funding in our state for homelessness, and we're going to have a statewide conversation. There'll be a number of different bills with different ways to continue funding homeless services around our state through the document recording fees. Hopefully, you all will have an opportunity to talk to somebody from your legislative delegation, and especially Senator. The Senate has been traditionally the tougher place for that conversation. And just tell stories, you know, share about how those dollars get spent. I think that's a really compelling way to communicate the value of the investment, because we all pay it. Every time we buy a house or sell a house, that's where those fees come from.
Can you just clarify, Commerce did study to look for other resources and revenue, and you basically determined that there really isn't anything else, isn't that true?
Yeah, it was we had a statewide or a conversation, a big stakeholder conversation about that, a meeting, a half day meeting about, you know, what other, and we pulled people in. A lot of people in the room were people who do a lot of work with the legislature and have a sense of, okay, realistically, could we get these same dollars from this other, you know, from the general fund or from other sources within the state, or another, a different way to generate a fee? And there was no conclusion there other than the document recording fee, or no strong recommendation.
So just to reiterate, the document recording fee, so the sunset simply cannot happen. It is beyond unacceptable. It would mean basically shutting down the homelessness system for our community and not really having one. It'd be a 65% cut in our funding. And to take that a step further, not only do we need to make sure that doesn't happen, but we really need, you know, as I talked about before, we have the capacity just does not meet the need right now. So we really need to be talking about an increase in resources, not a 65% cut. So that's going to be our major focus for the state session. I think looking more long term and more big picture, the presentation that Carrie did, it is going to be very difficult to locally, jurisdiction by jurisdiction, across our community, across Washington, across the country, get every single body of elected officials to start implementing along those lines. So I think we need to start thinking about some broader, even though that is where those decisions are made locally. In the public health world, there's something called health in all policies, where they try to get you, you know, no matter what policy you're thinking of, you have to think about health. We need sort of like an affordability in all policies movement around housing. We need some general principles that maybe we could get adopted at the state level and to really get some more tools for our local communities, cities, towns, counties to use, because we are coming out of a 50, 60, 70 year period where we've been doing the exact opposite, and it's going to be a lot of work to turn that ship around.
I don't have anything near that grand, although I support that 100%. That's impressive, yeah. I would say locally, and I'll probably butcher this so Vanessa can rescue me again, but I think getting involved with the Regional Health Alliance, they're sort of forming under a new governance structure, and they have a new executive director. I'm pretty optimistic about the work that entity is going to do going forward, but to have strong housing voices and homelessness voices involved in the work that they do. That's supposed to be a feedback loop to the local health plans and to the state as far as how integrated care is going. And with the Medicaid waiver coming online, I think having people have their finger on the pulse of how that's impacting homelessness and housing locally is important. And there'll be people who do housing, like organizations like us there. But voices outside of organizations like us, I think, would be helpful too. So tracking that, speaking up, offering feedback, that kind of a thing, to assure that the 5-year demonstration demonstrates good things.
Certainly the sunset of the document recording fees, I think, is an issue. But I think that's sort of the a tactical issue. And to your point about a larger picture, Michael sent me some stuff the other day to look at, and ending homelessness, or at least getting to functional zero for homelessness, and how do we as a community maybe have a commitment to that and have it be clear? And not just as a community, I don't know if the state has made a commitment to functional zero, and what does that mean? And if we're talking about homeless in Camas now, it's not just the city of Vancouver, it's all over Clark County. So at a high level, if we can advocate for a goal, and what does that mean? And is it veterans? Is it families with children? Is it generally functional zero homelessness? If we can get that picture and that vision, then we can kind of coalesce around it as a community and then start talking about what are the details we need to make that work, and how do we get our cities all around the county involved in that larger goal. So I would support some sort of vision in that regard, if there's a way that you can advocate for that, or or develop that strategic vision. I think that would give a lot of us an opportunity to say, okay, what do we need to do at the policy level, the state level, the local level, and everybody be working in the same direction to housing first. And there are over 30 communities around the country mm-hmm. that have functional zero, and three states. Mm-hmm. So it can be done, and I don't see why Washington State and Clark County can't lead that cause. So I would look to something like that personally.
And we appreciate that because 20, 30 years ago, we had communities in this county that said, no, we would not. They would not have multifamily housing. They were only single family housing, and that meant no apartments, no duplexes, no ADUs, zip, nada. So when there were a problem, they came to Vancouver. And when you come to Vancouver, you continue working west and you center your services in one particular area. No one wants to live in West Vancouver because all those people are down there hanging out, trying to get food, clothing, and shelter. So I would absolutely appreciate the opportunity of a requirement that all of our cities and villages in the county take on a responsibility of setting goals for housing so that they that workforce housing, that multifamily housing, whatever you want to call it, everyone is responsible to help house the people of this county, and it doesn't just center on the city of Vancouver. Document recording fees, absolutely. And that's an issue that this group has been lobbying for quite some time. So I'm sorry it's still there, and it's going to probably continue to be there. But we'll be up there up in Olympia with you because we'll be asking for that warming shelter, that day shelter that turns into a warming shelter when the temperatures drop below freezing because Living Hope Church can't handle all of it. And we don't want people freezing on our streets. And so those will be the things that we'll be working on.
I want to thank all of our panel members for taking the time to come and talk with us and have these discussions because they are very important. And we hope that we will take this information and we will share it with our friends and family and our coworkers. And we hope that you take these conversations and share them with who you know so that we can expand this conversation and really make sure that the focus is on our most vulnerable populations here in Clark County so that we can make policy changes and we can really do things to make a difference for our low-income community. So thank you so much
for
coming. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
So it's break time, and I brought out some more snacks. Always need more food. But this is chocolate. So there's some good desserts back there. There's still pizza and other things to snack on. And so, yeah, I had...
Cool.
We
thank you.
Time.
Was nice meeting you.
Of course. It was great to meet you.
Yeah. Good stuff.
You know what I'm saying?
Good stuff.
Nice to meet you again.
We should get out. I've heard a lot about you guys.
We love having Casey on the side.
Do
you have a card? Do you want to give me one of mine? And then you can reach out to me. How do you want to do this?
So cool. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great.
So,
yeah,
but it's just the beginning. So, That's the direction I want.
Sorry.
How are you doing, guys?
Well,
how are you?
No, I have some interesting news that's just kind of all come together in my head. So, this last school year, we identified fewer. We were kind of confused. And at first, I was like,
okay.
There is so much going on.
And then I started getting calls from folks who used to be aren't now.
Which is fine.
Some of them are working for you.
Oh, I know you're
for the homeless.
I know, yeah, seriously. I mean, if you're
and
all
come
like
up
me,
to me and said, Lydia, I was in a car 6 years
now,
ago, and you got me in touch with this, and it changed my life.
It's been a long time.
Yeah, we have a lot of things.
So there's those kind of calls. There's a call from a store manager out where we live that said,
I just lost track.
I was in my car with three kids a couple years ago. I got it all together. Now I'm managing a store, and you want to donate turkeys to all of the kids in your program for Thanksgiving. So I started to see that, like, wait a minute. Maybe these people actually aren't homeless. Maybe it's not that I wasn't identifying them. Something's working. So, I don't want to speak too soon and jinx it, but what we're trying to do is replicate that work that I've been doing and spread it to all people. So, like this grant that we just got a grant for $25,000 through OSBI to provide mentors for company youth who are counseling. But all of it is based
on
three basic things that I've now learned. Lots of other things, but what it really comes down to is, for me, just a personal belief that I think we're all here to live a full life, like live to your full potential. Like I believe we're here to just great things.
The same as everyone.
When people are living a half a life, right? And that's what I feel like a lot of our family, where they're at. They want it. They don't want it. They're not choosing it. Like, they don't know how to get it. So one, and this is also what I'm hearing from families when they're coming back to me, but that first conversation I had with you was the first time I had hope. Okay. So that's the first thing. One is hope.
So
along with that,
speaking
of that, so I've got to know in the first 30 seconds
I think
from my family,
that
whether they're not going to have a hillbilly or whether they're not successful.
But housing is not an
husband
and
this is a personal challenge.
And I don't see much
my language is different with that North County hillbilly as it is
and absolutely
I mean, I
huge difference in terms
it's just
of
that
what does it look like happening where I'm going what I'm talking about
that
is
we lose track of
is it's not a silver
treating
bullet.
People
and I don't
like
think
it
I think they're very
and
very
making it real I think the government's the second thing they need is they need the actual how do I go back to school as an adult?
Really, what we're talking about, when we talk about support,
how do I
leave
this domestic violence situation? They don't know those roadmaps for
employment support.
And that's what my lifelong curriculum
or educational support
working
is the solution.
That's what that is.
That housing support is the solution. Just like
the biggest challenge
is support structure.
Setting up the voicemail. And I got some like life 101 basics that isn't happening. They didn't get it. So that's the second thing. They need the tools, the actual roadmaps, the how to do it.
Thank you again.
And the third thing, you know what I'm going to say, is the eyeball to eyeball human connection with somebody. And somebody who knows their story. The last thing that they want to do is go to Vancouver and deal with some other agency that's going to deal with some new case manager. But when they can text me when they're falling asleep, because I know their story. I just had a student text me just a little bit ago. Hey, I'm going to be absent today. I need to help today because I need to find a partner now. You know, they're in touch with me because they know that I know their story and that I care. You know what I'm saying? So I think we get into trouble with setting up too many programs and right. And so what I'm excited about is that with this grant, and it's a very short term, money's going to be gone for June,
we don't have good. It'll at least give the next battleground, which is the organization that we're talking about. In all honesty, I've already got the mentors. I've already got the students. We're just setting up to them to match them all up. And my ulterior motive is to set up the processes and the procedures so that Connect Battleground can continue and then be able to provide those mentors to adults that I work with, not just on the company view. So it's just kind of setting a framework for them, you know. But it's actually working.
No, and that's my
it's cool. But I want to be a little bit, I don't want to say hush-hush about it, but I don't want to, because I want time to prove it.
7 p.m. tonight.
I want time to roll in the numbers and actually show that this actually does work. And the fact that my numbers did reduce in the last 3 years. Really does.
I love these. I make them. I love coconut.
Yeah, I do too.
But we'll solve it in that.
My family, not me, but my family is
going to solve
sugar.
It's going to take those families who have those particular barriers and remove them from the system, which is going to open up some opportunities for the people. That, so that's the latest. I'm a little bit excited.
Yeah, just about that.
How does that work? There are, remind me how many school districts? There's 3 school districts.
Within Clark County?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, no, there's probably, 10, 15? We've got little, we have a one-room school district, Green Mountain, up in North County. Oh, yeah. And we've got La Center, Ridgefield.
Ridgefield's its own school district.
Oh, yeah.
It's probably 80% of the students are in the Evergreen, Vancouver,
yeah,
and Battleground,
the big
and then
three.
The other 20% are in
yeah.
17.
Yeah. Washougal, Camas.
So obviously the little tiny ones don't have their own. I mean, they have a eventual liaison.
Exactly.
The vice principal, who's also the bus driver, is also
the other thing to keep in mind.
But so in the big three, do those have a dedicated or how do
they're very active.
Very active. The three of us are very active. The other thing to keep in mind, as far as shut up, Lydia.
Well, the challenge for a lot, right, is that
put our next presentation up.
You know, it's something I just will have. Well, like I know at Thurston County, right? We've got one school district with a full time person, and the next one with half time, and then the next one with the number.
And that's what I was going to say. Is the number of students identified throughout the state, in all honesty, from what I've seen, and it's not anybody's fault or anything like that. It's just the seriousness of the issue in schools. School districts are not in the business of solving homelessness. They're in the business of educating children, bottom line. So that homeless problem over there, that just, and that's how it is, honestly, in a lot of districts. So the number of students identified, I believe, is in direct correlation to the number of hours that staff person is
paid.
So the fact that it's become more of a bigger thing, districts have more hours allocated to that. So they're identifying more kids.
No,
so it's a little misleading.
No, that's totally true.
Thank you both again. You can stay up for the orientation if you want. But
thank you.
I don't think you want to.
I'm going
to
try not to
snore. I couldn't get the two, and I ran out of time.
You did, and you were like, no, I don't need very much time.
I know. I got excited.
But I think that was probably one of my favorites.
Or just somebody in other commerce to help you figure out something.
I'll tell you the story sometime of what I got in the other 2 words.
Sprinkles and meow.
This is a story about. This is my new job.
It was a story about a cat at the shelter.
So are you doing both?
No, that's the old job. That's the new job. This is like one of the best. I'm not going far.
Andy, I could not be more excited about Kate. Like,
seriously. you're going to get more people angry at me.
You're going to rile us up.
Sorry, oh my God.
always the troublemaker, Lydia.
I know. But I am delighted. Sorry,
Speaking of Kate.
Michael, it's just because we know you guys got this.
Speaking of how much you own. No, I need to hire a new Kate. No,
yeah.
I'm wondering if you'd be interested in
hiring.
Yeah. Well, I don't have one more yet.
Okay.
I've been going through
the impact of elections.
I think people are a little afraid too right now.
That's what I wonder. Whether it's just like, oh, I'm not.
I know.
Service providers,
it'll be interesting to see. I know as in the school system, I don't know if you've seen this, but people are
leaving you out here.
Very unsure about how the elections will affect.
I think we're just trying to.
It's cold out here. I got to close the door.
And stay under the radar.
Yeah.
You hope for the best in everything, and I think there's enough issues we have trying to just get the funding we need. But that's not.
Yes.
No, it's a real issue. It's around the state.
Yeah. It'll be interesting.
Are we ready? I'm going to try to speed through this orientation. So you get to hear me one more time for the next, I'm going to try this 45 minutes. So the executive team thought it would be a really good idea if we kind of went through the board orientation one more time. We did it for each of the members as they came on board. But, you know, when you're new to this, this is very overwhelming. And so this way we can take a look at it again. Where you have a better understanding of what's going on and what the advisory board does. So, as you know, we are the community action agency for Clark County. There are technically four caps, public caps in Clark or in Washington State. And I've left my notes over here, but one of them is a. They only receive money specific for their employment program.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
And that's the one I'm having a hard time remembering.
Some kind of core.
Yeah. No, I thought I had.
It's like a volunteer core, Empire core, or something like that.
I must have left my notes back at the office. So there are really technically four caps. However, one is just only receiving employment funds for their program up in Seattle something. So this is our new mission. The CAB mission is to follow the DCS mission. So we've already talked about this today. But we do make sure that we are talking about the economic security. That's a big part of what the CAB is all about, is bringing every individual into economic security. The purpose is to promote institutional and community changes which address the causes of poverty and to remove barriers to self-sufficiency. When we work on the community needs assessment, part of the requirement is that we look at the causes and conditions of poverty in our community, and so that's definitely going to help with the CAB, meeting the purpose of the CAB. We want to reduce the impact of poverty on communities, families, and individuals by providing resources for services which are responsive to their needs. We heard previous presentations talking about how we want to make sure that we provide services that are need-based, right? It's what do you need, not a one-size-fits-all type of program. So we've been moving this way for the last few years, but we always have room for improvement there. We want to promote innovative approaches to addressing the causes and impacts of poverty in the community. And the CAB is one of the more flexible funds, the CSBG funds are more flexible. And we've been able to do innovative programs in the past. Sharon, with Partners in Careers, we were one of the first funders for their pilot program, which you may have heard of. It's called Youth First. It's now being funded by the schools, and so we don't have to fund it anymore. That's why they didn't come in for more funding. They've been able to get the schools to pay for those services, but we piloted some of the funding that we did several years ago. We want to serve as a catalyst for community efforts to leverage additional resources which address the causes and impacts of poverty. That's where you guys come into play big time when you're talking to everybody else, saying this is what's going on in our community, and what can you do to help us reduce poverty and other programs, and what can we do for our community. and make recommendations or take other action on any other subject as referred by the commissioners. And I keep forgetting to change that. It should be counselors now. And so really have that conversation with our counselors about what needs to be done and listen to the counselors and see what they say this is where we should prioritize. So it's a two-way conversation. The objectives for the CAB are to understand priority needs of our community, which is being done through the community needs assessment, to provide approval of information documents. So we do that almost every meeting, but we have lots of things that we approve when we look at the report to the community needs assessment. There's a myriad of documents that you guys get to review. Review outcomes of programs, and that's required out of every meeting that we get together with. And to really make sure that we're paying attention to the programs and what they're doing and that they are meeting the outcomes. So we really, you know, we quickly enter the numbers into that report, but we will look at them, but we also rely on you guys to see, like, this doesn't make sense and explain this to me, and then we can take that back if it's something, an oversight on our part. We ask that you advise the counselors regarding funding decisions, and that's done through our request for application process. We ask that you advise for those who are, advocate for those who are low income, and we want to encourage collaboration and efficiencies, and we've been really moving towards that, especially with our request for application, where we're asking every agency to collaborate with multiple other agencies, not just one, but really, and not just partnering. It's more than that, it's collaborating. It's really working together, not just referring to each other. We ask that you uphold the CAB bylaws, and we ask that you establish a legacy that preserves human dignity and response to basic human needs. We say this several times in lots of different documents because it's really important that there is dignity and that we remember that the people who we serve through our programs are people, and they're in crisis, and they need our help. But when it comes down to it, they are people, and that's the first thing that we need to remember. The objective specifically for 2017, we want to continue to bring CAB into full compliance with the federal organizational standards. We're very close. There's only, I think, four or five standards we're not in complete alignment with. Part of that is the community needs assessment, so by the end of the year we will. The other piece is the strategic plan that the department is working on and that you had an update on today. In the public and private sectors, serve as an advocate for, in the low interest of low-income populations of Clark County. This will always be there. It's always an objective. It's a big deal. We need to publish an annual data report to the community, which we'll do later this year. We need to complete the triannual community needs assessment, which we will get done this year. And then we need to understand how the work of the CAB affects other systems and can more strongly integrate into community efforts. And one of the ways we did that was that panel discussion today. So I really appreciate the executive team bringing this idea to us so that we could really push that and bring different sectors to have a conversation. If it is just only about homelessness to this time, we can expand that to other conversations later on, but really bringing everybody together to have a conversation. So we're already meeting 2017 objectives, and it's only the 10th of January. Congratulations. As you guys really know well, the board structure is that we are a 9-member tripartite board that is made up of citizens, people who are low-income or represent low-income communities, and 3 elected officials. They're 3-year terms, and you can have 3 terms max. We have an executive committee that has the chair, vice chair, and the secretary. They are renewed every year. There's a lot of growth potential being on the Community Action Advisory Board. Going from just attending the meetings to Lydia being the chair and understanding and having a knowledge in how parliamentary procedure works, right? It's empowering to feel like I know what's going to happen when I go to other meetings, and this is how the process is going to work. And then also, all meetings are open to the public. So if you have anybody that's interested, have them come to the meeting. I can add them to our distribution list so they get notified when we have our meetings. I'm happy to go talk to anyone in a community that wants to know more information about what the CAB does or what we do in the Department of Community Services. We, now that Kate's gone, we don't go to as many meetings because we just don't have time, but we do go to a lot of meetings, and we ask that the board goes to a lot of meetings that are of interest to them and bring that information back to the board. But we start here in the middle with the CAB, and we have the Asset Building Coalition, and I attend those meetings. There's the CHARGE, which is Community Health Programs. I try to attend that as often as I can. We have Council for the Homeless. We obviously work with them very closely, and the coalition or the coalition of service providers. There's specific work groups that come off of the coalition of service providers, and one of those is the youth work group, and I attend those meetings. Lydia's there pretty frequently also. There's also DSHS, which we have a good partnership with them now because of some specific funding that the governor actually put in place a couple years ago and requires us to sit down with DSHS at the table. There's the local planning area. This is employment-based. Kate used to go to this. I will be going to this. Sharon Pestet actually leads this meeting. And we have the school districts, which we work with as closely as we can, and the Food Bank Coalition, and I attend those meetings as often as I can. This is great information and great connections to pantries and what's going on at ground level. In our unit, we also have the Urban County Policy Board, so this is more on the affordable housing side and infrastructure-type projects with some federal funds that come to us. And we also have the Veterans Advisory Board, which is some local funds. So we make sure that when we're doing things in any one of these groups of funding that we're thinking about the impact on the other groups, too.
Do you have regular meeting with DSHS, or is it just... it's out there.
So they're wraparound meetings, and yes, are they monthly, bi-monthly meetings?
Bi-monthly
meetings. And what it is, it brings the housing providers, employment providers, DSHS, all to the table for families that are receiving TANF. It's a requirement for TANF-funded families to participate, and so that's really what came across. So they are at the table.
Okay, and the one thing I don't see on there is... substance use issues, is that into one of those or something? Because I thought that was a part of...
So there's integrated care is coming. So in the past, we haven't had the linkages to them as closely as we will in the future. Lifeline has come in for funding. Community Services Northwest has come in for funding for the CAB's pot of money.
Mm-hmm.
But they tend to go to the Urban County Policy Board for funding. So we do have connections in our unit, but not as closely for this board itself.
Can I just interrupt you on the local planning area that you were asking about?
Mm-hmm.
So I attend those meetings, and they're really awesome because they're a partnership between DSHS, WorkSource, school districts, and it's wrapped around the family and talking about what type of interventions is that family, what are they doing to look for work, where are they at, and what can we as a system collectively do to help them get out of the situation that they're in. It's very cool and great.
The nice thing with that is that the family's not telling their story to 10 different people,
right.
And they're also not able to adjust their story to 10 different people,
yep.
So everybody's on the same table,
yep.
At the same table with the same story.
Yep.
And, I am on the Behavioral Health Advisory Board, so if in future meetings, if the board wants information about what's happening with integrated care, I would be more than happy to report mm-hmm. out and let you guys know. We just got our new board put together
mm-hmm.
a couple months ago, so we're getting started though. We've got a lot of officers elected, and we're moving along. So. I will be more than happy to provide information about what's going on.
And that's great.
Board.
And that's one
because,
of the things that we need.
Yeah, it's like a circle,
mm-hmm.
homeless, mental illness, and it's a circle. It's a vicious circle.
It is.
So have you ever thought about having board members attend these meetings, like on sort of being a... semi-appointed to different ones?
In the In the past, we have provided a list of all, a lot of, obviously not every meeting because we don't know of every meeting, but we've provided a list and contact information and when their meetings take place, and it should be in your binder. Hopefully, it was in your binder.
I do have a binder.
And if not, I can resend that out. And so, there's no requirement, and we value that you're volunteering your time a lot just to attend this meeting and to do that outside advocacy work. We would love that you would attend to these other meetings and report back. That is our hope. And they're all open to the public. If there's public money in that, it has to be open to the public. So,
I'm on four if you want to count.
That's it.
I'm on four of those, and honestly, it does help me really stay connected.
Yeah. So the feedback I'd give on that is I don't see us ever requiring or designating memberships. It's not like the Board of County Councilors where, you know, one is going to be the county representative
right.
to the council for
right.
and stuff
yeah.
like that. But, you know, in terms of encourage and support, you know, from my perspective, any connection to the broader efforts, it's that collective impact again.
Yep.
You know, the more exposure you have, the more powerful the impact that this board can be.
So
I was also listening to, you know, as you have more workload, there may be fewer of these meetings that you can attend all the time, and that it might be useful to have, you know,
sure.
so.
Yeah,
so
and
if
even
there
if
was some that would help, I mean, you know.
Even on those meetings that we're able to attend, you know, every person picks up something different at those meetings,
mm-hmm.
so having two ears is, four ears better than two. I found it in Judith's binder under rules and regs, the last page, so if I created your binder, that's where it will be. If you were pre-me, meaning Kate, I'm not sure exactly where it might be. But I'm more than happy to send that out to the board.
Sure, it's here.
So to talk about, we don't have 2016 funding information yet. And finance would bring my neck if I went and asked them right now because we're at end of year. so this is a little outdated. But over the last several years, the funding really hasn't changed all that much. Even when we had the ARRA funds, it was still rather proportionate. So in 2015, I mean, it's almost a third each as far as local, state, and federal funds. And then the local is the marriage license fee, which goes straight to the YWCA for the domestic violence program. We have the human services fund, which we fund a couple of different programs there, including volunteer lawyers. And then we have our document recording fees. There's three actual document recording fees. We lump them all together. And that goes a lot to shelters and then to some rent assistance programs and outreach programs. And then our state funds consist of the Consolidated Homeless Grant, which has two or three pieces, the base funds, which is for rent assistance, but then there's also the Homeless and Essential Needs Program. And then the Ending Family Homelessness Program. This is the one that's the TANF-based funding. And then we have community services block grants from the state because they receive their own money from the federal government and then they reallocate it down to us and to the different community action agencies. Federal funds, we have the Emergency Solutions Grant. We have LIHEAP, which goes straight to CPU. They are the ones that administer it for us. And then we have the federal community services block grant funds. But these are seen monitored by the state. So even though there are technically two different funds, they're all monitored by the state for us. So this is just another way of looking at and breaking down how much money we got. So the community services block grant from the state's very limited. This number is quite high. It's usually closer to $45,000. This was because we had such an influx when marriage rights came through, and so we had a lot of people decide to get married right after that. So we anticipate this to go back down. Then we have the Federal Community Services Block Grant Funds.
Is there a fee when people get divorced? Maybe that's a place for...
that would should be the place for funding the safe choice, isn't it? I know there's fees. I don't know what they're used for, but I do know there's fees. It's expensive.
It is expensive.
I don't have personal experience.
I remember what.
Yeah,
it was like $300.
So then we have the Human Services Fund. This is we had some reserves. When we went through the recession, our finance unit was very conservative because we were very concerned about the document recording fees specifically. And so we were conservative on how we used the Human Services Fund. But then in 2015, once things started leveling out, we said, okay, we don't need to hold these in reserve anymore. And then we made sure we started spending those funds again. And then we have the Consolidated Homeless Grant and the HEN program as part of that. Then our document recording fees, so you can see significant amount of money there, and then LIHEAP, which we get a tiny bit of admin money for that, but really it goes straight through to CPU so that they can administer the program. Any questions there? Is this feeling more comfortable now that you've been in the program and in the board, so you kind of make sense now?
Didn't Vanessa say something about LIHEAP going to a different department?
Weatherization.
Oh, okay.
So it's another component.
Okay.
But yes, the weatherization program,
yeah.
The administration of the program is in the Department of Community Development. The Department of Community Services still does the finance side of it because it's grants-based accounting, which is very different than what community development does. So it's better
yeah.
for us to take care of that side of
gotcha.
It to avoid any
yeah.
findings.
Yeah, yeah.
So we have three focus areas. We have the community action programs, which are anti-poverty upstream type upstream type services that we use the Human Services Fund, CSBG, and then LIHEAP funding for. We have our domestic violence program, and then we have ending homelessness, which is where our consolidated homeless grant, emergency solutions grant, and our document recording fees go in. So this is really going to be the shelters, the emergency crisis homeless system. That's new words, lots of words today. My words are not working anymore. These ones with the arrow are the ones that we wrap into what we call community funds. Makes it a lot easier for the board, but also for our programs. We don't tell them you're getting, when we do our RFA, we don't tell them we have $247,000 of Human Service Fund up for grabs, and you can apply for that. And we have $2 million in document recording fees, you can go with that. We lump it into one pot. It does specify on their contracts because it has to, but it's just easier to know that it's one big pot. So with community action, like I mentioned before, it's super flexible. There's a lot of things that we can do with it. Currently, we're funding 211 Info. We're doing Share Hunger Response Program for food. We have two employment programs, Columbia River Mental Health, which is focused on people with disability, and Partners in Careers, which is more of a general population type program. We have asset development with Share and their individual development account program, and we're doing financial counseling. And obviously it's a need because it's coming up in our survey, so we'll make sure we continue funding some sort of financial counseling program. But we can do a lot of different things. We in the past have had more youth programs, but we don't have them right now, or senior programs. We can serve, do specific veterans programs, but we have veterans funds that we get, that we go directed to veterans. Dental, we've done dental in the past. With the Medicaid thing, it's a little harder because we don't want to duplicate services, so it kind of put a little bit of a wrench in the system, but we'll continue to look at this because we know it's a need. So we'll see what we can do there. Housing, of course, domestic violence. We can do early childhood education. There's a lot of programs in the community that do early childhood education that are not being used to their full capacity. So I know as staff, I would like to advocate for those programs before we started using our funds there. We have reentry program, or we've done reentry programs in the past. We can do education and training, which is how we pay for or would use for the Matthew Desmond, going and seeing him. That would be a training opportunity for you. We can do transportation programs, catalyst programs. there's a lot of things that we can do with CSBG, and which is why we try to get as a wide variety of applications when we do our request for application process.
And employment services, too. That's
yes.
a biggie that we push with PIC and CBAB
yes.
and all the rest of them. Yeah.
Yes. We have...
We haven't left the CSBG funds.
I'm sorry?
Well, you have on the left the currently funded, you're talking CSBG funds.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that is by CSBG.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I can't remember the last time we did not fund an employment program.
I know. That's,
I've
yeah.
been here for 7 years, and right. I know there were I came in mid-contract, so mm-hmm. I know it's been longer than that.
Mm-hmm.
On the housing and homeless services side, we're funding shelters, outreach, rental assistance, and we have four different types of rental assistance, prevention, however, very limited funds for prevention, rapid rehousing, permit supportive housing, and transitional housing. We also do community planning. We contract with Council for the Homeless because they do a really good job of being able to make those connections with faith-based organizations and things like that. And then, of course, coordinated assessment, which is a requirement for our continuum of care funds. So some of the program requirements is that we have to have a contract. So we contract with all of the agencies. And we have, for a long time, have had outputs in our contracts. This last time, we've really focused on making sure that we have outcomes in the contracts. HMIS is a requirement for the housing funds, the document recording funds. And then we do have some reporting requirements. We have the quarterly reports, and part of that is the national performance indicators, which we have to send to the state, and that's what I will be doing tomorrow. We have monthly invoices that they send in that have to be reviewed to make sure that the backup to the information is all there and accurate. And then we do regular monitoring and desk reviews. Some of our funding requires it every year, some requires it every 2 years, and some requires it every 3 years. So we try to keep a close eye on the programs, where their funding is coming from, and how often we need to go out and review the programs to make sure that they're using the funds adequately and doing the best that they can to provide the services out to the community. We have our two task forces. We have the Advocacy Task Force, and we have the Community Needs Assessment Task Force. This task force will go to the end of the year, and then we won't need it, and then we'll probably revive it when we get ready to do the next community needs assessment. The advocacy task force is kind of winding down and looking at different things that they can be prioritizing and focusing on now that the first year is done, and they really, the idea was to get that strategic plan in place for providing advocacy. The board involvement, we ask that you engage, learn, ask questions, share, support, which you all do very well. And so we greatly appreciate the conversations that we have at our board meetings, the feedback that you give to staff, the questions that you ask that we go back and research. You guys, we have no concerns about any board involvement by any of the members that we have. And then the last couple of slides are just all about open public meeting because it's a requirement in my board orientation that you know about that these meetings are open public meetings and that we have to abide by all of the different rules of open public meetings. So I'm not going to go into detail on this.
I like the adjournments.
What?
I like the adjournments one.
What does it say?
Who's going to declare it adjourned?
If only
the rest.
That's when the staff comes in. Well, I'm declaring that we're not having this meeting. There's some weird ones, but there were things that we didn't realize that we weren't doing. One of them, that it's in the orientation, so that's why it's in. Yeah. So that is the board orientation. A very quick nutshell, because I know we're all tired, and I'm definitely tired. So
wow.
We just listen.
Yeah. It's hard to sit there and listen, though. I know. I've been there. Us, Michael and I and Janet, we're always here. So anytime you have a question, anytime you just want to bounce back some information, we're always here to help you guys.
Do all of you board members that are here right now, do you feel comfortable in your roles and kind of what the role of the CAB is and your piece of it?
Yes.
You feel pretty okay with...
More so.
Mm-hmm.
This is like my third or fourth board, so yeah.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of really, this one's homeless and hungry, and my other one is behavioral health advisory board, and
mm-hmm.
then my other one is
family youth systems partners roundtable. So I ended up on three this year.
That's amazing. That's awesome. Some things that have come up in the past that I just want to kind of touch base with all of you on and see that this training is kind of addressing that.
Yeah.
Is it kind of the limitations? I feel like in the past, board members have been a little bit concerned about like overrepresenting the board or underrepresenting the board, that sort of thing. Do y'all feel more comfortable with that part of it?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah?
I've started announcing to people that I'm on this board and, mm-hmm. oh, what is that?
Good.
You know,
good.
And I've told people that it's an open meeting,
good.
You know, that they can come. So.
Good.
Yeah. My family says I have a big mouth, so I think that I do really well on all the boards because I'm a big advocate. I got my kids 13 years ago, and they were all had special needs and mental health issues, and you have to be not really necessarily a mean parent, but a pushy parent, advocate for your kids, and that's kind of when I found my voice,
mm-hmm.
and it hasn't toned down at all, if you would ask my mom, because she advocates with me.
So then, Rebecca, that makes me feel a lot more comfortable that we collectively have
yes.
been able to meet that need for board members. So that
yeah, and you know, just remember that you are a member of the CAB, and we want you to go out and we want you to talk about what's going on and what we talk about here and share that and make it a bigger conversation because there's only us to do that, right?
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Awesome. Rebecca, thank you. It was good to have a little refresher.
As fast as I was talking. See if I could talk
okay.
faster.
Any other questions, concerns from any board members? Or Michael? Or Jan? Y'all just want us to hush up and go home?
No. I'd say, you know, number one is, you know, thank you, Rebecca, for putting today together. You know, it was a lot of hard work.
Absolutely.
And thank you, Janet, as well. I questioned you guys is, you know, you've had the half-day retreat / work sessions. You've now had a full day. How did today feel? You like the full day more?
We had pizza, so.
I was here for an entire day, so I'm not sure that I can speak up and say how it felt for a full day, but I've been at full day meetings for other things. It's, from other individuals, I heard it was overwhelming, that it was a lot of information.
Mm.
We've been talking, staff has been talking, and I mentioned it briefly with the executive team that we are feeling that every one of our meetings is so jam-packed with information that every meeting feels overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And so we used to be a monthly board meeting. And when we had new leadership, we were directed to cut back on the number of meetings. But the executive team would like to propose that we go back to a monthly meeting, or at least have a discussion about going back to a monthly meeting. And then we could get more program updates, so we could get more programs in, and we wouldn't need to feel so rushed getting through some of the information.
And kind of somewhat disconnected for, you know, it being so long between meetings,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah, and I was kind of wondering when I looked at that schedule every other month, how, you know, my thought was every month for an hour and a half, how do we... that's a short meeting,
mm-hmm.
to get a lot of information when you got a month in between and there's always new information,
mm-hmm.
coming out,
mm-hmm.
always. So I would definitely
based on open
you
public
know
meeting,
support
doesn't this have to be a
monthly meeting
an agenda item on the agenda to be
it's
able to
so I'm just putting it out there, and
oh,
it will
okay.
be at the March meeting because we'll
okay.
have the more
yeah.
of the board members there.
Where
and
are we
sure.
going?
No.
I'm going to step back from the
yeah.
table for a minute.
No, so we want
to. I know parliamentary procedural.
What we just want you to think about, one is, do we want to have it more frequent? Do we want to have it the same time? Do we want to have the same length? Do we want to have it on the same day? So this board is here for you guys, and so what works best for you is what will work best for staff, and so that's what we want to make sure that we're doing, and I don't need to be gaveling down on my water bottle. So I apologize.
I'm
making my point very, very thoroughly. So we will have the conversation.
To March, so, and have ample time in, on the March. I know we try to add in quite a bit of information, but could we have
substantial amount of time or to discuss it, because I think they'll be, for whomever's there.
What, and substantial is a relative term, so what would you say is substantial?
Probably 30 to
45
minutes.
Minutes. Yeah. Maybe
and depending on who's there, maybe for those people who can't attend, they can put their feedback in ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
And can we have it as an agenda item to adopt a new time? Because otherwise we discuss it.
Right.
And then it doesn't get done.
Another 2 months before we adopt it.
Mm-hmm.
So
is that something that just the question and the idea can be sent out through email so people that aren't here can think about it, and the ones that are here, we can.
So my plan was to include it in my email message when we
mm-hmm.
I do. It's my idea is to send it send out the information in the email, the reminder email that I send out a week before.
Sure.
So that it is one of those things that gets people are thinking about before they get to the meeting.
Yeah, but does it then have to be the next meeting we vote?
Oh, no, we can put adopt on the agenda.
Okay.
Yeah,
we'll
it just has to be
discussed
in open public meeting.
Yeah.
It can be discussed via an email thread.
Oh, I personally applied knowing it was every other month. And so for me, that I thought, well, okay, I can manage that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I can't be here in March, but I just, it's certainly, I can appreciate the concerns about
mm-hmm.
the other, but I don't know how that will work out.
Yeah, and that's why we want to have that discussion. And
mm-hmm. part of it, too, I don't feel like we have enough ample time to discuss some of these things. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I'm like, okay, we've got 3 minutes left.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and we still are in the middle of a major discussion about something.
And
so
when I said email, I'm sorry to interrupt, I didn't mean to have a discussion about it through email. Just send out the idea so everybody that's not here can have ample time to think about it.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to have to look at schedules and kids and work and all
Judith,
that
I
stuff.
Sure hate to lose you if we went to every month.
Well, I've called in, and I'm going to have to do that in March. But
well,
it's not that. It's just, and I wish I could say I'm doing something really critically important for the community, but I'm basically not.
Cancun?
Arizona, actually.
And our, you know, our attendance,
you don't want to call in.
Our requirements are fairly lax. So having it being a monthly meeting is not, we're not going to require everybody's there at every single meeting either.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I mean, I really do try to work my schedule around it.
And we could, I mean, another idea is we can extend the meeting, you know, keep it bimonthly and extend it for another half an hour or, but we know that also is hard on schedules.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really trying to find a balance. So now imagine trying to do this with 12 people.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing is that, well, that's why I'm saying a half hour, 45 is probably to get everyone's in.
I'll definitely get a half an hour in there. It's already a tight agenda as it is, but I will make sure that there is a half hour.
Well, I can say Tuesday mornings are council meetings, and I typically like to attend council meetings, and they start at 10 o'clock. So as soon as we extend it, it's hard.
Yes.
Personally, I think that.
And Tuesday, we don't have to be Tuesdays.
Yeah.
It cannot be the second Mondays, that one I have to strike because of other meetings. But, I mean, we can do a different meeting that works better. We can do in the evenings if that is what you guys prefer.
Yeah.
I mean, we're really flexible and are here for you. I just want to let you know, we're here for you guys. What works best for you, staff will make it happen.
I personally
like during the day myself. But.
As I turned over my calendar to the new year, I realized I don't have the dates on there. So at the beginning of year, if you could set up which dates we're going to do, whatever you decide at the March meeting, to stand exactly what dates those are.
Yeah.
It would be really helpful. Then I can put them in.
Not a problem.
If I can.
Rebecca, I can't thank you enough for organizing
that was
today.
Great.
No problem.
Amazing. Seriously, I know a lot of work and effort went into it. So
I want to put on the schedule to have a conversation about how today went too, so we can get your guys a little bit more feedback on how you felt. Because it is a lot, and I do understand.
And the key is, I mean, it's incredibly good, and it's due to both Lydia and yourself sticking to the agenda like that when you've got people like me who ask questions.
We're just going to bring duct tape next time.
I know.
Sometimes I
but
don't leave
still,
the meeting
I mean,
because
no,
of
to
I
maintain the agenda, even though I'm being very respectful.
Where do
that.
You want the name tag?